South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
All right. Well, a very, very good morning all across South Texas and the Hill Country and wherever you may happen to be listening on the internet. It is getting closer and closer. Well, I guess it is spring now. I can't say that anymore. It's not getting closer to spring. We had the first day of spring earlier this week, and weather's really starting to moderate, looking like it's not going to get severely cold anymore this year. Hope that's the truth, but I sure think it's time to start planting things out in the vegetable garden, getting things into the flower beds. I mean, next Sunday's Easter, so we're just knocking on the door of being absolutely certain that spring is here to stay. Jimmy Taylor's pretty much got open line, so give me a call, 210-599-5555. This is what I call the smart people's half hour, when it's easy to get in. And if you have a question that takes a little bit more time to discuss, we can take the time to do it. I don't have to take a commercial break until 6 o'clock. So, once again, you know the number, 210-599-5555. What's new this year? There's some beautiful new varieties out there of various things, from impatiens, especially the New Guinea impatiens, the so-called sun patiens. Some absolutely outstanding varieties of petunias. Now, petunias are going to be one of your best bloomers through the spring months and early summer. Going to fade out when it gets really hot by the time it's time for periwinkles, and it'll probably be time to forget about the petunias until next year. But lots of things you can set out now. The impatiens, the begonias should be just fine now. Caladiums, if you buy caladium plants, I think you're fine to plant them. The soil is warm enough that they will do okay. If you're going to grow your caladiums from bulbs, either hold off a little while or start those bulbs off in pots. The soil is still cool enough that if you stick bulbs in the ground, especially if we continue to get some rain and several chances again this week, but caladium bulbs in cool, wet soil, well, lots of times they tend to rot. Once they have started growing, that's a different story, and that's why I think you're fine to get pots of caladiums, large or small, and go ahead and get those set out. But if you're planning to start your caladiums from bulbs, once again, I'd hold off at least until after Easter. We'll see what the weather does. These cool mornings down in the 40s and even low 50s, like we're having this morning, that's keeping the soil cool, and that makes it just a little early to be putting the bulbs in the ground. So if you want caladiums, go ahead and buy the plants. If you're going to plant for bulbs, hold off just a little while. Other things that I wanted to mention, everybody is interested in so-called elephant ears, and I want you to know that there are two types of elephant ears. The biggest ones, and the ones that are probably most commonly sold now, are what they call the upright elephant ears. And these have been on the market 3 or 4 years, a relatively new thing. You'll recognize them because they have kind of a tall stem that comes up out of the ground, and then the leaves form. Many, many different varieties of the upright elephant ears, properly called alocasias. Unfortunately, they're not as cold hardy, so I would recommend putting them in at least a semi-sheltered area. They're happiest where they have sun in the morning, shade in the afternoon, although some of them, especially the great big giant types, will take full sun. Saw some up at the Dallas Botanical Garden a couple of years ago that the individual leaves must have been close to 6 feet across. So there are some real monsters in the alocasias out there. But if we get a cold winter, they're going to freeze back, and occasionally the whole bulb just kind of rots and dies. The other type of elephant ear is properly called a colocasia. It's the kind that my grandparents and your grandparents probably planted, and lots of smart people still do. The bulbs, instead of being slightly elongated with kind of a long neck on top, the bulbs for the colocasia type of elephant ears are almost totally round. And they're the size. You can get them probably on average, they're going to be the size of tennis balls. I don't think I'd settle for anything smaller than that, but more likely, especially if you get out early, you're going to find them more the size of softballs. They don't have any neck that comes up out of the ground. They are much, much more cold hardy, like I say, my grandparents grew them up in Dallas, and I don't ever remember a year off when I was growing up that they failed to come back and come back strong every year. So if you're thinking of planting elephant ears, just realize that there are two different types. The alocasias, you have a wider variety of varieties, so to speak, wider choice of varieties, some of which are really unusual, some of which are really huge, some of which are variegated. Your standard green colocasia type of elephant ears, pretty much green only, although you will occasionally see variegated ones. Now back to the alocasias for just a minute. There are some of them that are really kind of tender. There's some real unusual colors. There's one really striking one called African Mask that is a dark, almost black color and has very prominent striping to it. Just a beautiful thing, but that one's a little more delicate, as are some of the other fancy varieties. Probably best to grow them in pots on a shady porch, patio, deck, whatever, and they will be absolutely spectacular all through the summer months if you do that. Well, Jimmy texts me that Ruth is calling and ready to talk, so I hate to keep people waiting. Good morning, Ruth.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for asking. And you?
About the same. Awful early. I can't say I enjoy having an alarm go off at 3:15 in the morning, but it's what I do on Saturday mornings, and I enjoy every minute of it. So, yeah, it's going to be.
And I'm extremely grateful for that.
Well, what can I do for you today?
Well, this is probably the third or fourth year in a row. I keep calling about asparagus, growing it in Texas, because it's different. But I don't know what I have a great harvest. And it actually was more abundant in February than it is, early February than it is now. But I get some teeny tiny sprouts.
Right.
And then they fern out right away. Should I be letting them, and I have chosen to let those grow and do this photosynthesis stuff, but is that killing my crop?
It is lessening your crop. I wouldn't say it's killing your crop, but there's some inner sense that the plant has that says, hey, we've got our fronds up and growing. We can cut back on putting out new growth. So once you let any of them, the little thin ones or, it's the big ones, once you let them start going to the ferns, the asparagus will cut way back on producing more sprouts. So since your bed is several years old, you ought to be able to harvest probably throughout the months of February and March. After that, it is good to let them go to the ferns, let them start putting some nutrient back into the plant. But when you leave those little ones, and they're different theories. Some people say the little thin ones are male shoots, the others are female. Some, I think more likely it's just, the plants are gradually, the crowns are getting larger, and they always start off with smaller sprouts and then eventually get bigger ones later on. But they're sure tasty. Nothing wrong with eating those little ones. And I tend to just, snap them off and into the mouth they go. But
right. They grow overnight almost to the point of fronding out within a 24-hour period.
Right.
So,
those things you almost have to pick twice a day on them. And I usually save the bigger ones to cook. The smaller ones I just eat fresh, just snap them off and enjoy. They have so many different nutrients, so many good things in them. There's just not anything that comes out of the garden that is better for your body than asparagus.
Well, it is excellent, I will tell you that. So now different questions, unless someone else is waiting.
Doesn't look like anybody else has called in yet, so you just go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. We got rid of, we have a couple hundred trees around our property here, and we cut down an Arizona ash that was just gnarly and ugly and stuff. Anyway, I now have some beautiful morning sunshine on on a strip of flower beds in on the front at the front porch.
Very good.
Wonderful. I'm now wondering what can I put in it. I do have some oxalis out there, and I have an old Easter lily that I had stuck in the ground, and it's a foot and a half high.
Oh yeah, it might actually bloom around Easter this year, although it probably
might.
Yeah. Are you looking? Well, I'll tell you both annuals and perennials. If you're looking for annuals, golly, you can plant caladiums, you can plant begonias, you can plant impatiens, you can plant things like what we call Persian shield, strobilanthus with its almost iridescent foliage, coleus. There are 100 varieties out there, and they get a little taller, they're a little showier. There's a so-called lollipop plant or pachystache will grow well there. There are lots of different annuals, which of course you replant each season. And some people want to have things that die out in the fall so they can plant winter flowers, like that would be a great place for cyclamen or German primrose. Those are shade-loving things that'll do with half-day sun that grow in the winter months. On the other hand, if you'd rather not be bothered with replanting occasionally, there are some perennials that will do very well with morning sun only. Some of the biggest and showiest are plumbago. There's a light blue, a dark blue, and a pure white form of plumbago, all of which would love that spot. Shrimp plant is always showy, and it's a favorite of hummingbirds and to some extent of butterflies. There are a number of different salvias that are shade tolerant. Now, there are also a lot of salvias that have to have the sun. But in the shadier area, there's one called smoothleaf sage. There's another one. I especially like the one called eyelash sage. Dark, dark red flowers. And botanically, it's called Salvia blepharophylla. But it is a really pretty thing. There is a deciduous one that freezes down, but it virtually always comes back from either seed or from the plants. It's called Salvia coccinea or tropical sage. And it comes red, pink, and white. So they're, and it's just a pretty little thing. And, anything with red tubular flowers, you're going to have hummingbirds just flocking around it. But those are all perennial things that would do very well in that bed. He's trying to think. In a mild winter, your plumbago will remain evergreen. Most winters, your shrimp plant will remain evergreen. Really cold winters, they're going to freeze down, but I've never had them fail to come back.
Uh-huh. I do have a question on, now the salvias, the deer tend to leave alone.
For the most part, yeah.
I do have some old-fashioned red salvia out near the road. And the deer tend to leave them alone. But you called, it was interesting you said salvia, but I didn't know that salvia and sages were in the same family.
Well, once again, salvia is a botanical name. Sage is a common name. There are many different plants in a number of different genera that people call sages. You have your leucophyllums that people call the purple sage. You have your culinary sages. You have so many. There must be 100 different varieties of salvia that are grown as ornamental flowers. And over just, again, a number of different genera. The Jerusalem sage is, very different from Salvia greggii or Salvia leucantha, the Mexican bush sage. But truly, I think there are probably 100 different varieties of salvia. So it's hard to generalize, and there are more of them that do well in the sun than do well in the shade. But the ones I mentioned, the smoothleaf, the eyelash, the coccinea, those are all salvias that will do just fine in bright shade.
Oh, that sounds fabulous.
They are. They really are. They're quite showy.
And I know me. I need it to come up year after year after year. That's what the oxalis does.
Oh, yeah. And what color of oxalis do you have?
It's a pretty little pinkish lavender.
Okay, there is a real showy one. And that is a naturalizing oxalis that, in my opinion, just gets prettier and prettier year after year. So it's a great choice. There is also the purple-leafed one, which has a pink flower, and it is perennial. There are the ones that people call shamrocks that have the green leaves and the white flowers. I find on those two, the shamrock and the purple leaf form, about every 3 years, you have to dig them up and plant them deeper. They actually grow from a little bulb-like structure called a corm, and it's like somehow it just rises up in the soil, and after 2 or 3 years, you'll see they're just right up on the surface of the soil. At that point, dig them up, divide them if you like, just plant them down deeper where they're, maybe a couple of inches down in the ground. And the purple one especially is very, very striking.
Oh, I guess I'll have to swing by your facility later. That is where I got my original oxalis about 5-6 years ago.
Oh, and I love that pink. That is probably, some people call it native. I don't know if it's actually native in this area, but it certainly does adapt well. And with just a little care, it'll come back year after year, whether it's a warm winter, a hot summer, or a cold winter. It's just a real champion, and so it's just so pretty and so easy to maintain. Nothing but water and throw a little fertilizer on it now and then, and I can't say I've ever seen an insect problem on it, and it's very, very dependable. I think botanically it's Oxalis crassipes or something like that, but it's a wonderful thing to have.
Now, I only have the one plant that I purchased and planted, and it did that survive that freezing, that with the big freeze we had a few years back.
Yeah.
But it also has never been eaten by the deer, which really surprised me. I thought I was just planting expensive deer salad. But
well, you obviously aren't just overrun with deer. If you lived in Hollywood Park or Fair Oaks Ranch or somewhere like that, the deer would probably eat it because they're so hungry. But where you have a reasonable deer herd out there, they leave a lot of things alone. But since we've taken away all their natural predators, the mountain laurels, and most importantly, this parasite called screwworm, the deer just population just exploded. And if 9 out of 10 deer across the hill country died, it would be the best thing that ever happened to the deer population because they're all malnourished. They, especially in harsher times, they truly are hungry. They'll eat things that are very bad for them. But when you get a year like this where we've gotten somewhat regular rainfall, the deer are in pretty good shape and they're back to living mainly on their native browse. They're not having to clean out your flower beds in order to get by.
Right. Right. Very good. Well, thank you. This has been important information for me.
Well, it's always good to hear from you. Call me when you think of more things, Ruth, and you get out and have a wonderful, wonderful Easter week and Easter weekend next week. And looks like we've got Sue and Debbie wanting to talk too. So Sue is next in line. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
This past Tuesday, I had my sod replaced in the front yard. I was getting letters from my HOA that I needed to do this, and it's a St. Augustine, Texas native. And I was told that it would be cut, I was told it'd be cut the evening before and that it would be put in within 24 hours. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's only been a few days, but to me, the grass looks really, really yellow. It's got lots of brown. It's got mushy areas. There's not very much green to me. So I was wondering if be expected that it would look like this if it was really cut within 24 hours.
How did it look when it was first put down?
Yeah, it looked, it wasn't satisfactory to me at all. It looked yellows and browns and mushy areas.
I think you got misled. That's what it does when it stays stacked on pallets, and that's not a good thing. I mean, I would to get it back into good health. I would treat it with whole ground cornmeal. I would fertilize with organic fertilizers. You don't have to wait. You can put fertilizer out before the grass even goes down. But I would sure have a talk with the company that did it, because I sounds to me like they did not do a good job of it, and I would certainly file a strong complaint with them that it didn't look good from the day it was installed. So
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe it's too early in the year that when they cut it?
No, it's a fine time, and I don't know anything that I would just call Texas native St. Augustine. That's you could call it Texas common, but sounds like these people don't know a whole lot about their grass. Is your yard sunny or shady?
Parts of it are very sunny, and parts of it are like half of it's shady and half of it's sunny.
Yeah. In the sunnier areas, there's a variety called Floritam that is by far our most sun-tolerant and heat-tolerant. In really in deeper shade, the Palmetto, the Del Mar are the two best varieties. Uh-huh. But Texas Common is not bad St. Augustine, just across the board. But no, it should have looked good from the day you planted it. Did they roll it after they put the sod in?
No, that was another thing I was going to ask you. They did not.
You got a crappy grass company. They don't know what they're doing.
I went through Angie's.
Well,
and it was highly recommended.
I would write your own review there, because rolling is the single most important thing you do when you plant sod, because it takes out the air pockets between the sod and the soil underneath. And sounds to me like these people did not know what they were doing. And anyway, just from what you're telling me, I'm not looking at it with you, but the fact that they didn't roll it right there tells me that they don't know much about planting grass.
Okay. And that first day he had told me, I met with him, I met with like three companies, and this guy was, he seemed good. He was eager to talk to me. He didn't rush me. And he said he didn't till the soil. He would aerate it. But then when they put it in, I says, well, when are you going to aerate it? Well, we're not going to aerate it. We're just going to spray it with something called Hydro Holder. Are you familiar with that product?
Oh, I know that kind of product, but it should have been done before the grass was planted. I would write a not so pleasant review, or at least threaten him with writing a not so pleasant review, because you got taken. I mean, these folks are not treating you right, and you can probably, the grass will probably survive. It will come out, but you're going to spend money on cornmeal and fertilizer, and you did not get what you paid for, from what you're telling me. So I would be pretty critical of them.
Okay, because it looks like I need to put what I used to use in the past, Ironite. It's so
yellow
and
Ironite is it can be a toxic material. It is basically Colorado mine tailings. If they weren't selling it as an agricultural product, it would be considered toxic waste. So I'm glad Ironite's not so much around anymore. If you want to use a common iron product, you can use what they call green sand. If you want to use a better product, there's a product called Azomite, A-Z-O-M-I-T-E. Okay. You don't have to use a lot of it, but it's got a lot more than iron in it. It's got like almost 100 different elements and beneficial compounds in there. And it's not a fertilizer, but it is like a super, super vitamin source for your plants. But I just use a good general fertilizer, Medina or Nature's Creation or Maestro Grow, something like that. And like I say, I put some whole ground cornmeal, because it sounds like you've got some fungus started in the grass. But
I know. That's what I thought, too.
I'm sorry to tell you, but you got stuck with a bad company there. So I would very definitely file a complaint about them. Especially
I tried calling him yesterday. He didn't pick up. I was expecting I was expecting 50 shades of green, but I got 50 shades of
right. You know what I mean? And if he promised aerification, the only aerifier that works is what they call a core aerifier, and it's not a bad thing. But if they promised and didn't deliver, I think you've got good cause to really complain about them. Listen, I'll get Jimmy to put you back on hold if you want to talk a little more. Right now, we've got to go to news here on KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
Oh, but hang on just a couple of minutes before you dial, because all four phone lines are taken. We're going to talk just a little more to Sue, and then it'll be Debbie, Juanita, and Kit. One other thing I would strongly recommend to you, Sue, is get out and take some pictures of this yes. grass and the problems with it, so that you'll have some evidence. And like I say, I've never used Angie's List, but I think they're pretty really? Picky about the people that are on there. So I would certainly let them know how dissatisfied you are.
Okay, I did take some pictures already, right from the get-go. And I thought, well, and I take a few every few days and see mm-hmm. if I see any changes.
Right.
Yeah, I was disappointed because I was looking forward to having it done. But if I use a product called that you like, Medina Has to Grow for lawn, mm-hmm. is that
right.
equivalent to like putting down Growing Green? Are they pretty equivalent or maybe?
Medina, the Growing Green is a dry granular product.
Right.
And it's something you would put on like every 3 months. If you went with the Has to Grow Lawn, it is a liquid. It's probably faster acting, but you need to reapply it about every 30 days. So the liquid acts a little faster, but has to be applied more often. The granular is much longer lasting, and you don't have to put it out nearly as often. So you do whatever's convenient for you.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then if I compost, that would be like more in October.
Anytime during cool weather. We put on compost from the time it cools down in the fall until the time it gets hot in the spring, and that's usually October through late April, early May. I unfortunately don't have a crystal ball that works when it comes to
right.
weather. Excuse me, but anytime during the cool months is a fine time.
And then cool would be like less than 80?
Less than 90. Less than 90.
Oh, okay. Less than 90. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that gives me more leeway. Okay. Okay. I'll try that. Okay. Okay. I hope this works out. So.
Well,
okay, thank you,
good
Bob,
luck with it. You can probably bring it back, but you shouldn't have had to do that. You should have had beautiful lawn
uh-huh.
from day one.
Right.
How often are you watering?
They told me to do it every day for 2 weeks.
Yeah, do it every day for a week, and then cut back to every second or third day. After a month, you should be able to cut back to once a week. But you want to get some good, strong, new, healthy growth started on that grass. So stay in touch with me. I want to hear how it does.
Okay, so do water for 1 week every day, and then every three?
Yeah, well, for 1 week I'd water every day, then I'd cut back to maybe every other day. By the third week you could do it twice a week, and then after a month you should be
okay.
able to water just once a week. And for these first 2 weeks, you don't water for any great length of time, you know, probably 5 minutes.
Oh.
As once we get a little further along, then you want to water less often but more thoroughly. But just a quick, about 5 minutes of good water, again, for the first week every day, then just start backing it off. And hopefully
uh-huh.
by that time you'll have some good roots. You ought to be able to go out after 2 weeks. You ought to be able to go out,
okay.
and when you try to pick up those squares of grass, they should be firmly attached to the ground.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'll watch for that, too. Okay.
Very good.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob.
You're certainly welcome. Thank you, Sue. Next in line is Debbie. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a couple of questions, and my husband put out beneficial nematodes on
uh-huh.
Thursday.
Yes.
And the reason he did that is because something has been digging holes in our backyard, and there's not much St. Augustine grass back there.
Right.
Also, we've been seeing June bugs. But my question is, whatever's coming under the fence, we haven't had an armadillo in years, but if something is digging the hole, does that mean there is a grub there or they're just looking?
It just really means that they are looking. Now, it might not be armadillos. It could easily be raccoons. Unfortunately, it could also be skunks. And they're after earthworms as well as grubworms. So they're just kind of digging around for whatever they can find. But if you're seeing June bugs, it's time to get the beneficial nematodes out. And we're starting to see a lot of June bugs, so I think it's going to be a year that we need to treat with the beneficial nematodes a little early. But again, you might go out at night with a flashlight. Raccoons and skunks will run off when they see you. The armadillos won't pay much attention to you until you get pretty close to them. So it'd be good to know what it is so you can know what the best way to deal with them is.
We were stopping up any holes under the fence, new holes, and I thought, well, if there are grubs, maybe we should leave the hole open under the fence.
No, I would go ahead and stop up the holes. But if you've got all the potential entry points blocked and you're still getting digging, it tells me it's probably a raccoon. If it's a small hole, it could also be a squirrel, because those two creatures will go right over the top of the fence. But skunks and armadillos, a good fence will stop them. So maybe you can at least determine what you're dealing with, and then we can talk about things that might repel them.
Okay, and then my next question has to do with, we want to either start a compost pile or a worm bin, and what would be the pros and cons of either one?
Compost pile, if you have the materials to go into it, or you can take what the neighbors put out by the street or whatever, compost bin will give you a lot more material than a worm bin will. A worm bin will give you a higher quality, but it's called vermiculture, but raising worms and collecting the castings is a lot more work. You might say that composting is passive, whereas, you know, it's going to take some active participation on your part to feed your worms, and like I say, you generally, there's a special little structure that is made for growing the worms in, and then you sort of scrape the castings off the bottom, and it gives you a very, very high quality soil amendment. But growing worms is a lot more work than composting. I would be, if you have a yard that gives you much material as far as leaves or clippings and things like that, by all means, keep a compost pile going. And then if you want to supplement that with some worm bins, all the better.
Okay. And then how could we get more grass growing in our backyard? We have a lot of trees, so we have dappled sunlight, but we have some sunny areas. And I think because of the leaves from the oak trees and the drought last summer.
Yeah, mainly the drought.
It was a full good yard of grass, and now there's not much there.
Well, I would certainly fertilize any good organic fertilizer, and I would think about putting down a thin layer of compost. That's going to help your existing grass more than anything else you could do. Yards took a beating last summer. It was so hot and it was so dry that even some of the tougher grasses like Bermuda suffered, and St. Augustine suffered big time because in most places you just couldn't give the grass as much water as it needed. But some good fertilizer, regular watering, and where you have the time and the energy, just a very thin quarter to half inch layer of compost will really help things get out and come out and spread quickly.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much.
Well, you are certainly welcome. I appreciate the call, and we'll move on to Juanita. Good morning, Juanita.
Good morning. How you doing?
Off to a good start. It's going to be an absolutely gorgeous spring day out there.
Yes. I just have a couple of questions. I am a new gardener, but I'm just thinking about a raised bed garden. Is it safe to use the galvanized metal for your raised garden?
You can certainly do that. It's not necessarily the best material because galvanizing involves putting zinc onto metal, and zinc is toxic to plant roots, so any roots that grow right up against the edge will be burned by the galvanizing, but if it's any great size. Once you get 6 or 8 inches back into the bed, it'll be just fine. A better choice of materials would be, they make this synthetic wood product they call Trex, T-R-E-X. I think it's just ugly as sin, but it'll last forever. And it is a good thing to create a raised bed out of. Some people use cinder blocks. If you want to use a really high quality wood, the EcoVantage wood is by far the, you know, the best, most durable wood on the market. But for doing a raised bed, the Trex is just fine. And like I say, it'll last 50 years for you, and it's easy to use. You use screws or nails just like you do with regular lumber. And it's actually a lot stronger than that galvanized metal is. A galvanized metal, when you start putting soil up against it, it can bulge. It will definitely start rusting. I'm just not crazy about galvanized metal as a, you know, creating a raised bed. I think there are other better things.
Okay, and the question that you brought up, the cinder blocks. I was reading about the cinder blocks. They were saying that it might leak lime into the soil.
No, don't worry about it. We got more lime in the soil. I think the soil may leak lime back into the cinder blocks. if in doubt, just wash them off before you put them out. But no, it's they of course do use limestone to make cement, which is what they make the cinder blocks out of, or actually concrete. Cement is the binding agent. You mix sand and things with it, and you get concrete. And that's what those cinder blocks are made of. But any lime leaching out is going to be minimal and not any more harmful than putting Edwards Aquifer water on it, which is also full of lime.
Okay, my last question is, okay, I'll be watering by hand, and I was reading about don't let the water hit your leaves and everything. I'll be mostly watering by hands in the morning time. Is that the best time to water your plants?
I think it is, but I think it's a joke to think that you can water without getting water on the leaves. And here are the only problems with getting water on the leaves. If it's the middle of the day and little droplets of water stand on the leaves, each little droplet of water can act like a magnifying glass, and sometimes you get just a little burn spot underneath. Watering in the evening can create some fungus problems because the number of fungal spores in the air goes up very greatly overnight, and if a fungal spore lands on a dry leaf, nothing happens. If a fungal spore lands on a wet leaf, it can sometimes germinate and cause problems from mildew to, you know, some different things. But it's crazy to think that you're not going to get any water on the foliage of your plants. Just water the ground as much as you can, but don't be standing out there with a dish towel trying to drive things off, because, you know, Mother Nature, we love, you know, getting the leaves wet when that good rainfall comes down. So
yes,
it's not that bad, but where you have the choice, yes, watering in the morning is better than at night, but absolutely do not worry about getting water on the leaves. It's not going to be any major issue at all for you.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate your help. You have a blessed day.
You do the same, Anita. Thank you for the call this morning. All right, Kit, hang on just a minute. You'll be up next, but it looks like I get to pause here for a moment, and I get to talk about Kinetico. Speaking of water, you know, our water is just so full of lime, so full of calcium that it can be really hard on things like, I've got a washing machine that makes its own hot water, your dishwasher, your hot water heater, all those things. So the lime can be very damaging to them over time. When you have a water softener, though, it's gonna take the lime out of the water. It's just that there are two different kinds of water softeners. The old standard ones run on electricity, and you're in trouble if you have a power outage or a power surge. Very susceptible to a lightning strike, and that kind also are run by a little computer that tells the rosin in the water softener to recharge on a certain schedule. Well, if you're not using much soft water, you're wasting a lot of water. If you're using a lot of water, well, it might need to recharge more often. But if you get a good water softener like a Kinetico, Kinetico systems run on the energy in the water. They do not plug in. They do not have a computer to burn out with the lightning strike, and they only recharge when the rosin needs to be recharged. It's a twin tank system, so you're never going to run out of soft water. It's just a peace of mind. You just don't think about your water softener when you have a Kinetico. Sure, you have to add a little salt now and then, just like any water softener, but your Kinetico system is a smart system. Doesn't really require any help from you. I love my Connecticut system. I've had it for many years now. They're so sure you'll like it, they'll let you try it for 90 days before they want you to pay for it. If you're in the market for a water softener, check them out. I truly think they are the best on the market. In fact, the water softener industry voted them the most efficient water softeners out there. Connecticut. Give them a call at 210-656-PURE or check them out online at ConnecticutSA.com.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster.
News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, back to gardening. We do have some open lines now, so grab one of them if you like. 210-599-5555. And I get to say good morning to Kit, our Skit this morning.
Doing wonderful, Bob. How are you this morning?
I'm about the same. Just looking forward to a beautiful spring day out there.
That it shall be, that it shall be. Hey, just a couple of quick questions for you. First, I harvested some mountain laurel pods over the winter from a nearby bush. What is the best way to get those started?
Well, mountain laurel is a very hard seed. Of course, you want to break the pods open, cut them open, whatever. You can. I just use something like pruning shears and either cut the side off or just something so I can get those red seeds out. And the, you know, if you threw out 100 seeds, probably two of them would sprout this year because of that hard coating that allows them to sit there for years until the weather's right. But what you want to do is scratch them, in effect. You don't have to cut a hole in the side of the seed or anything, but you just have to break that kind of waxy covering. Some people will take them and just rub them on a piece of sandpaper or carborundum paper. Other people, you know, I know one guy that takes his little fine pliers and just cuts them for, or touches them for half a second to a grinding wheel. But again, you don't have to actually make a physical mark on them. You just have to scrape them on something hard enough that you've broken that wax coating so that they can absorb moisture, which leads to having them sprout and grow. The commercials, growers, they'll take the seed and throw it into a gym tumbler or something like that, put it in a little, you know, sharp sand or carborundum or something and tumble it a while. But most common thing, people just put it between two sheets of sandpaper and rub them back and forth a time or two. After that, soak them in a mixture of Garrett juice and water. In the case of a hard seed like a mountain laurel, probably for at least 30 minutes, and then plant them. Not everyone will sprout immediately, but a much higher percentage of them will germinate and grow. You should see them sprouting within a month to 6 weeks.
Okay. All right. That sounds great. Moving on to a few vegetable questions.
Yeah.
My broccoli never seemed to get me any broccoli, but now it's all flowered out. Does that mean I'm beyond the chance of getting broccoli this year?
Well, of course, the part you eat on a broccoli plant is the flower bud, and the warmer it gets, the faster it goes from being buds to flowers, and the flowers aren't much good to eat. So you might as well take those heads that have gone to flower and just cut them off, and then watch carefully. Again, you'll have new little smaller heads of broccoli form, and they're absolutely delicious, but whereas in the winter months, going from the bud to the flower might take a week or 10 days. It can happen much more quickly when the weather gets warm. So you're probably going to be harvesting every day, and you're probably beyond getting great big heads of broccoli, but you ought to be able to, you know, harvest and enjoy stuff for at least another month.
Okay, great. And then my Brussels sprouts have gotten a whole bunch of, like, holes in the leaves. I'm assuming it's snails, although I have yet to see one. What can I do to stop that? I know it's almost at the end point of Brussels sprout season too, but.
Well, it's much more likely a little green caterpillar, called a cabbage worm, and they go after broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, and, fortunately, they're very easy to control. If you want to spray a safe product, well, I wouldn't tell you anything but safe products, but, the product called Spinosad will kill caterpillars on contact, means you have to spray very thoroughly. If you want to make it a little bit easier, you can get a product that contains what we call BT, stands for Bacillus thuringiensis, which is why we call it BT. But BT is safe for people, but it is a stomach poison to caterpillars. You mix a little molasses in it to make it more powerful and to help it stick a little bit better. Spray the foliage, in fact, you can spray just everything in your vegetable garden with it, because it works against tomato hornworms and all kinds of caterpillars. But the caterpillar takes one bite of a leaf that's been sprayed with BT, stops feeding immediately, and dies within a few hours. I think if you went out with a flashlight at night, you'd see these little caterpillars, especially on the backside of the leaves. But that is much more likely what's doing the damage than snails or slugs.
Okay, and how often should you spray the BT and their BT and spinosad?
Well, if you're spraying the spinosad, like I say, you have to actually get it on the caterpillar to kill. So
okay.
You'd probably be doing it fairly often. The BT, with no help, it's probably going to last at least a month. I spray my vegetable garden fairly regularly, not as often as I'd like to. I don't have as big a garden as I'd like to either. There's too much other, too many other demands on time. But I like spraying with liquid seaweed and molasses because it suppresses spider mites and it's so good for the plants. And I find that the molasses seems to keep the BT active on the plants. So lots of times I only have to spray once in the spring because I'm kind of revitalizing it with molasses periodically. If you don't have the time to do that, I'd probably reapply about every 6 weeks.
Okay. Yeah, once a month should be able to do that. So, all right. So I've been collecting my oak leaves, and now I have a good oak leaf mulch, compost, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Is that a good medium for seed starting?
Once if it's fully broken down to where it doesn't look like leaves anymore, where it just looks like good dark earth, it could be used. I'd like to mix in a few other things. I would mix in just a little bit of good garden soil. I would add a little bit of azomite just to get all the nutrients that it would need. But for oak leaves to go from being dry brown leaves to be in really good usable soil, it's probably 5 years or so. So if you've had your compost pile for a long time, yeah, the stuff you dig out down at the bottom of the compost pile, that's going to make a good seed starting medium. But again, I'd probably add some azomite, probably just a little bit of garden soil, just so it holds enough moisture to get your seeds off to a good start.
All right. And then final question for you, since you don't have a good crystal ball for when the weather is going to change. I wonder
right.
if the crystal ball could tell me when these oak leaves will stop falling.
Typically, give us another couple of weeks, and they should be 99% gone. Or one good windstorm. I'm sure you've done this, you go out and you take a leaf and actually run your hand over it. Most of those leaves are ready to fall off, so... we had some people got a good rain this past week. I was on the dry end and got like 5/100ths. My partner was on the wet end, 20 miles away and got almost an inch. If we get a good rain with some wind to it, things will be almost totally gone almost immediately. I think we're looking at a pretty strong south wind in a couple of days. So, 2 weeks they should all be gone by this time next week by Easter. They ought to be 98% of them gone for sure.
All right, sounds good. Well, I'll let you get on to your other callers.
Well, just keep in mind that once the leaves are gone, you're going to have to put up with those little tassels for a while longer. So you're not through sweeping the sidewalk yet, but the leaves at least are going to be minimal from this point going forward.
All right, sounds good, Bob. Have a great rest of your weekend.
You do too, kid. Thanks for the call this morning. I appreciate it. Connie and Teresa, you guys will be up next, but it looks like it's time for me to take another quick break here. And speaking of azomite, I get to talk about azomite, and I love talking about azomite ever since I discovered it, several years ago at a nurseryman's get-together. And the gentleman that was talking about it had this piece of poster board, listing in fairly small print all the different beneficial compounds in azomite, and it literally went from top to bottom. There are about 100 different between micronutrients and micronutrient compounds in azomite. Now, azomite is it's not a manufactured material, or at least it's not man-made. Mother Nature took a few million years to make it, and it is totally non-burning. You can use it on any plant, and it will do an awful lot to keep things green and growing well. There's a very finely patterned form that can actually be put in suspension and sprayed. I like the granular form where you literally just, you know, grab it by the handful and scatter it around. I like to use it in flower beds before you plant, whether you're growing vegetables or flowers. Use a lot on plants that are showing some yellowing after they're up and growing. And it's the only product I've ever found that will actually help yellow leaves if it's due to mineral deficiencies. If it's due to lack of water, that's not going to help. But in our poor soils and our very alkaline soils, anytime we're deficient in iron and zinc, well, it corrects those deficiencies, and the yellow leaves don't have to wait and fall off and start over. Yellow leaves many times will actually green up again. I'm so impressed with azomite. Been using it for a few years now, and I highly recommend it to use it to treat problems and to prevent problems. Look for it wherever fine natural garden solutions are sold. Azomite, azomite.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 1071.
All right, Connie and Teresa are my next two callers, and Connie is first in line. Good morning, Connie.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I'm happy to report that I got almost an inch of rain here in Smithville.
Very good.
I'm looking for ideas of a smaller size, like ornamental tree for the front yard. Now, I do have a Natchez crepe myrtle planted sort of in the front corner of this same yard. I was thinking of, what do you think about an anacacha orchid tree?
Anacacha orchid tree is a pretty, it's really more of a bush than a tree, but it's okay. A very hardy plant, beautiful white flowers, by far the hardiest of the bauhinias, and it certainly is a pretty plant. But it's not really going to be real tree-like. Your crepe myrtles are a little bit more tree-like, and of course, there are many different colors and many different sizes of them. Other things you could consider: red buds are, a nice small tree. They're both red and white, and I like, for red buds, I like the really dark pink one, a variety that's called Oklahoma, that is by far, I think, the prettiest one of those, and it's going to make a small tree. Something else is more like a big bush. Mountain laurels are certainly, fall into that category. Eventually, they become a little bit more tree-like. If you're looking
they're very slow growing, though.
Well, they grow faster than most people think. They'll put on 12 to 18 inches of growth a year, which is not real slow. Out of nature, of course, it's much slower where they're not getting watered and taken care of. If you want something that's going to grow very quickly, look at Vitex, V-I-T-E-X,
I have one of those in the backyard, and that thing is hard to keep control of.
Well, you want it to grow quickly, but not too quickly. But it certainly is a good choice. They're ornamental fruit trees. There's an ornamental peach that is not grown for the fruit, but just spectacular flowers. They're flowering plums that make nice small trees. Unfortunately, they're not super long-lived, but with a little care, they should last for 12 to 15 years. And that's not really too short, but they're, smaller trees. If, again, it would be very slow growing, but here at the nursery, we have a gorgeous Chopin holly tree that is that Pride of Houston variety, and we just couldn't let it take up too much room. So we trimmed it, made a tree out of it, and it's got a trunk that's 3 or 4 inches thick. It's about 15 feet tall, and has literally thousands of red berries on it. But I will admit it, you know, it took a while to get up to that size. So those are a few. There's again, a shrubby plant called a Mexican buckeye. It's a deciduous plant that this time of year it has beautiful pink flowers on it, beautiful yellow color in the fall. A Mexican buckeye is just an outstanding plant. There are, if you can find the old-fashioned photinia, now I'm not a fan of red tips. They have many, many problems, but the old-fashioned one they call Chinese photinia. There was one on the corner of my grandfather's house growing up, and it was about 10 or 12 feet tall and about 6 feet across, wonderful bunches of white flowers in the spring, and just totally trouble-free. So those are all possibilities, give it a little time. I can think of others. Bay laurel, the same thing that you cook with, makes an upright-growing plant that generally they're going to top out about 15 feet, maybe 18 feet. You can either trim them to be more tree-like or you can let them grow as a big bush. But if you enjoy spending time in the kitchen, especially doing any Cajun cooking, it's really nice to be able to have your own bay leaves. And so there's another good possibility. there are a lot of things that you can put that are going to make that big shrub, small tree look.
What about possum haw holly?
Possum haw is a deciduous holly. Again, it's going to be more bush-like. I can't ever see that I've really seen one trimmed into a tree, but they'll get 8 to 10 feet tall. I love them because they, you know, they're totally deciduous, so all you see is the bright red berries in the, you know, late winter. But possum haw is an excellent, excellent plant. Probably the best selection is one called Warren, W-A-R-R-E-N, Warren Red, is one of the showiest ones out there.
Okay. All right. Well, you gave me some ideas. Thank you,
and,
sir.
Well, you are certainly welcome. And, you know, don't forget about some of the tropicals, even though they freeze back. Esperanza will grow 10 feet tall in a year's time, and most winters it doesn't freeze severely. And it's going to give you flowers even more dependably than the crepe myrtle. It's going to give you bright yellow flowers, you know, absolutely all summer long. So anyway, there are an awful lot of different choices. Get out and look around. Maybe go down to the botanical garden where you can see some of these things grown up to a little bit bigger size. But lots and lots of good choices out there for you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bob.
You're sure welcome, Connie. Thank you. Let's go ahead and take one more call before we take this break. I hate to keep Teresa waiting too long. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have a jalapeno. I'm sorry. Serrano plants are growing great with flowers.
Uh-huh.
But when I was looking at it and I turned the leaf, because I was just touching leaves, it had a bunch of little brown little things on it.
Okay. Probably aphids, fairly common, not too destructive, but I would probably spray with spinosad soap. Spinosad is soap. It's a combination of insecticidal soap and spinosad. Totally safe in the vegetable garden, totally safe for you, and very, very bad for the aphids. Take care of most any insect problem you have show up. So without seeing it, that would be my guess. Aphids are about the only thing that tend to bother peppers, so that's probably what you're looking at. And spinosad soap will take care of it within minutes.
Okay, perfect. And then also, I think your staff over there know me every 2 weeks because I'm always over there buying the vinegar and the
orange oil.
The orange. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because I have the crabgrass that will not go away. All the other stuff is dying. I mean, it's good. But the crabgrass, I can't get it out.
Well,
of the grass.
Yeah, it's when it starts getting hot, the crabgrass will die out, but it's probably the most tenacious. That, along with a couple of the bigger dandelions, are the most tenacious of the winter weeds. But you can knock it out, or at least knock it way back with the vinegar and orange oil. But I tell you, I've gotten to where I'm just mowing it or weed eating it down because trying to get it before it puts on any seed. And as you know, we're not really into hot weather yet, which is a good thing, but it will die when it gets hot, whether you spray or do anything else or not. But at this point, I'm turning more to the lawnmower and less to spraying to try to control it.
Okay. All right, perfect. And then lastly, I have a plant, I mean a tree, that is trying to come back to life after the freeze.
Yes, uh-huh.
And I'm trying to, it's the pink mimosas, and I think okay. I talked to you about that one before. It is a little bit of life coming back, but at the bottom of the tree.
Well,
should I cut it down or should I just wait?
I would wait and see. Mimosas really weren't hurt much by the cold, but they were badly hurt by the drought last summer.
Yes, it's the drought.
Yeah, get a little bit of Super Thrive, mix up and water it in thoroughly with that. If it hasn't put more leafy growth on top by Mother's Day, then we'll give up on it. But a lot of things are really just now starting to come out, so I wouldn't be panicked today. I give it a little Garrett juice, I give it a little Super Thrive, and keep your fingers crossed. A little bit more rain would really help, and it actually looks like we may be getting into a slightly wetter period, so let's hope for the best there.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I appreciate the call, Teresa. Thank you. All right, let's take a quick break while you dial. I've got some open lines now, 210-599-5555. I get to talk to you about Fanix Nursery and Garden Center. 85 years they've been helping San Antonio gardeners. Same family, yeah, fourth generation now, hard at work over there. Fanix is doing another one of their special weekends with something off. They're doing all sorts of fun things to celebrate this 85th anniversary. But this weekend, it's products from Nelson Plant Foods. They make a lot of different specialty fertilizers, and Fanix is going to give you 20% off on all of the Nelson Plant Food products all weekend long, today and tomorrow. They also want you to know that they are well-stocked with seed potatoes and just about everything that you could look for in the way of summertime vegetables, like peppers and tomatoes and eggplants and all those sorts of things. They've also just gotten a new supply of roses in. They've gotten, oh, golly, just so many trees of all sorts, both fruit trees and shade trees. And they've got some brand-new Eco lithium-ion battery-powered outdoor equipment, some things I've got to get over and take a look at. They've even got a lawnmower or a riding mower that's lithium-ion battery-powered. Never seen that. Can hardly imagine it. But they carry all the Eco products, and they'll let you do a lot of things outside in a very quiet fashion, shall we say. Be able to get out and mow Sunday morning, and the neighbors won't even know what you're up to. Fanix has been around for, like I say, 85 years. Same place over there on Home Green Road, just off South W.W. White. And this is the weekend for all Nelson Plant Food products. Get by and see them. Tell them I said hello. We're over at Fanix Nursery and Garden Center.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, my next two callers are Jimmy and Mike. Jimmy's up first. Good morning, Jimmy.
Good morning, sir. Really appreciate your show. I enjoy it every weekend.
Well, thank you.
I listen every weekend. I am not a gardener. I was thinking about tomatoes and perhaps some kind of peppers.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if, are you familiar with 18-wheeler brake drums?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Are they suitable? Are they recommended?
They're heavy.
they're heavy, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, that's fine. There's no negatives if you clean them thoroughly, but no negatives at all to fill in those with soil and planting. You don't have to bend over as much that way, and you could grow... what is the diameter on what you're looking at? How wide across are they?
18 inches, maybe? Every bit of 18 inches, I would say.
Okay. On something like that, I would probably put two tomatoes, or you could put, I'd say probably three peppers. I always like to kind of double up on your tomatoes. You will need to have some way to brace them up. A tomato cage is best, but you know, we didn't even know about tomato cages when I was gardening with my grandfather, and we just, you know, staked them up. But the cages are by far the best way to go, but you sound like somebody that could probably fashion your own cages with a little bit of heavy fence wire. But, no, that's enough to grow pretty much whatever you want as far as tomatoes and peppers and eggplant. Those are all three things that would lend themselves quite well to growing in a drum like that.
Yeah, there'd be no toxicity from the clean brake drum, the used drum, right, going into the soil?
Well, you know, anything that sits in the position that those things sit on an 18-wheeler, they're going to pick up some road grunge over time. So you would want to clean them. You probably would use just any kind of a good soap or any kind of a cleaning agent, but there's not going to be anything in there that's going to be toxic to the plants or toxic to you. Just don't hurt your back
totally
in moving them around.
Yeah. Yeah, pressure washer and all that. Sir, one more question, please. Does sandy loam suffice, or do I need to go to some kind of planting dirt, you know?
No. Sandy loam is fine. You're going to bring some weed seeds in, but the weed seeds could blow in from anywhere, so you will be pulling a few weeds. I would add some compost to it, and I probably would add maybe a little azomite or something like that, but sandy loam would be a great starting point, that's for sure.
Okay, fantastic. I really enjoy your show, sir.
Well, I appreciate you listening, and call me back anytime I can help. And if you ever over our way, we've got a couple of little guides that we'd be happy to give you. I think Fanix does the same thing as well that'll answer a lot of those questions. But I'm always here for you Saturday and Sunday mornings, and we'll turn you into a gardener.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Joey. You do the same, sir. Thank you, and thank you for all you do out on the road. And Mike, hang on a second. We've got to go to news here. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now, 210-599-5555.
All right, don't dial right this second because all four lines are suddenly taken. It's going to be Mike, and then Steve, and then Shirley, and then Adam. First in line is Mike. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
Couple things. A couple weeks ago, you were talking about a buffle grass.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something about different varieties, and that there's one that comes like in sod.
Well, there's one that they call a turf type. Which is sold as sod, which is more a lawn grass, as it were. Needs lots of sun. My biggest complaint about it, it doesn't compete with weeds well. For instance, common Bermuda grass can take over and choke it out if the conditions are right for Bermuda to grow. But it is very, very drought tolerant, very trouble resistant, disease resistant. And that's the turf type. The other type of buffalo grass is more a clumping native grass that you really don't mow. But if you've got just an open area where you just want like a native landscape look, that type of buffalo grass it's attractive. It's trouble free. Doesn't really have any insect or disease problems that I'm aware of. Both of them do take good strong sun. I'd say minimum 6 hours a day, 8 to 10 hours is better.
What's the type that they're putting on the highways now?
The highway department uses a mixture for the most part of seeded grasses. Is not any one. They frequently include some of the buffalo grass, but they also throw in some curly mesquite, some Saito's grama, several different native grasses goes into the blend that they're using.
Okay, and you didn't say, for instance, on that turf, where could I find it?
You're just going to have to call some of the sod farms around. I think most of the companies producing it are going to be not over the... Your St. Augustine and Bermuda mostly comes out of the Bay Cities area over near Houston. I think you're going to find that South Texas is where more of your buffalo grass sod is grown. I don't really have a name to tell you, You might call Thomas Stone and Landscape up in Bull Verde, and Bill Thomas up there can tell you if he knows of a good source of it, or they may be carrying it. I haven't talked to him in a while, but if they can find a source, they probably have it, and they generally have the best quality grass of anyone in this area, but I'll have to check that out for sure for you, but that's where I would start.
Okay, great. And the other thing, last summer I planted Mexican sycamore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
About 10 feet tall, and it had a nice sized ball, you know, at the base, uh-huh. Maybe 3 feet across.
Okay.
And, you know, I dug trenches around it, watered the heck out of it, mm-hmm. has to grow, these other
stimulants.
You know, the leaves kept falling off throughout the summer and stuff, and as of yet, I don't see it trying to bloom. Is it possible that it died on me, or, you know, when should it start to show me something if it is still alive?
We've got four or five of them here at the nursery. Some of them are leafing out, but not all of them yet. So I wouldn't panic at this point. Winter was not cold enough to bother it, but the drought last summer, it was hard to keep them watered enough because they're already a bit of a thirsty tree. But I'd be, you know, every time you think about it, pick up the hose and spray up and down the trunk. If it's struggling to come out, that's sort of like an IV. You're not requiring the tree to take it up through its roots and then send it up through the trunk. As you know, it has that soft, smooth yes. trunk, so to speak. It will absorb a lot of moisture directly through that trunk. So just every time you think about it, you could do it 10 times a day, and uh-huh. the tree would benefit from it. That's okay, what's going to yeah. give it the best boost that you can imagine.
Yeah, I've been watering the trunk, like you say.
Yeah.
But I would not say 10 times a day. I doubt it.
No, if you do it a couple of times a day, that's great. But I'd say 10 times just to indicate you could not overdo it. It would be okay. happy if you could do it, but I envy you if you've got that much free time.
I do, I believe I was only doing it like once a day.
Yeah, no, do it two or three times a day if you have the time to do it.
Sure. Okie doke. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate you.
Always a pleasure. I appreciate your call, Mike, and we'll talk again. And Steve is up next now. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. My front yard faces more or less north, so it gets plenty of sun. And the yard looked very good prior to about 3 years ago with all the droughts and hard freezes.
Yep,
and
everybody's.
And I'm sure that it is not, you know, chinch bugs or something, because I've done the pesticide granules and. But what has happened is it looks, I don't know, the best way to describe maybe is a camouflage pattern or a dog with manes. Manes mm-hmm. might be more big patches, but a kind of a camouflage pattern. And uh-huh. So someone had told me that I should get the, you know, kind of rake out the dead stuff, get those areas back to the soil, maybe loosen it a bit, and then fill with some material to let the runners grow in.
And what kind of grass do you have?
It's St. Augustine.
Okay. Well, forget about the raking, because okay. you're going to damage the runners. If you want to use a leaf rake or something, you can certainly do that.
Right.
But
they said a soft-tined rake.
Yeah, I don't think it's not really going to do much except give you some good exercise. I would apply a good organic fertilizer, Medina, Nature's Creation, Maestro Grow, there are a bunch of good ones out there. And anywhere you can, top dress it with 1/4 to 1/2 inch of compost. That's going to get it coming out faster than anything you could do. Spray it down with Garrett juice, spray it down with a little bit of, you know, Medina Plus or something like that. But the good fertilizer, the good compost, that is what is going to encourage it to put on the strongest growth. Now, grasses really aren't growing a lot yet. I mean, we're into weather that really feels like spring, but these nice warm days are followed by somewhat chilly evenings and nights. So the grass just really hasn't started growing very much yet this year. But periodically, again, spraying it down with some Garrett juice, spraying it down with a little liquid seaweed. But the two most important things would be a good general-purpose fertilizer and that thin layer of compost on top. Once it starts to grow, I think you'll find that it'll go in much more a solid pattern than a camouflage look.
Okay, and I have done the first fertilization. I hope I wasn't too much early.
No, there's...
Can I do it again before...
If you fed within the past 6 or 8 weeks, you don't need to feed again. Okay. I figure, you know, at least 3 months of good fertilizing from a good slow-release natural fertilizer, so don't rush to do it again. You need a little warm weather more than anything else. Be sure that you're watering weekly, putting down at least an inch of water so that you're sure thoroughly drenching the soil. But a little warm weather, you've got the nutrients you need there. The compost with the humic acids and things will naturally soften the soil and sort of like an IV for it. Be a little patient with it. By the time Father's Day gets here, you should be back to a solid green lawn. I won't promise by Mother's Day because I don't know when it's going to really warm up. But you do you do your part with the compost and the water and the nutrients, and the grass should come back strong for you. We are seeing a lot of June bugs out early, and they're, of course, the ones that lay the eggs for the grub worms. I don't believe in the toxic granular pesticides. I would think about putting out some beneficial nematodes. They will take care not only of grub worms, but also fire ants and fleas and a number of other troublesome things, and yet they're totally harmless to people and pets.
Okay, quickly in the back, and I have, you know, not a big backyard. Neighbors, mm-hmm. oak trees give a lot of shade, and over the years, and I think it even started before the bad weather, up again close to the back fence and close to the deck, the grass has just kind of receded and it's more or less dirt there. Is it likely because it's less sun than it needs?
That would be the first thing I would think. Do you have a sprinkler system or how do you water?
I have to use movable sprinklers.
Okay. I suspect that you're probably not watering long enough when you water. When you turn that sprinkler on, somewhere out on the pattern, put a couple of just little straight-sided cans. They could be, empty soup cans, pet food cans, whatever else. And be sure you're putting down at least to an inch and a half of water each time you water. You should never have to do it more than once a week, probably this time of year even a little bit less. But we see that so often when people are watering plenty often, but they're not putting enough water down at one time. And the nature of the droughts that we've had, the surface may have pretty good moisture, but boy, you get down a few inches and then you've got 5 feet of super dry soil. And that's why people are having problems not only with their grass, but with trees and shrubs and things like that. So there's no such thing as too much water, but there is too often. So when you water it really thoroughly.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Keep me posted on how it does. I'll look forward to hearing from you.
All right.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Shirley and Adam, hang on just a minute. I'm to the point that I need to do a quick break here, and it looks like I get to talk to you about Rhonda's Nature's Way, and that is, I just love talking about Rhonda's because I feel like Rhonda is one of the, she and her staff are some of the principal people that just keep me full of energy and able to get out and do everything that I do in a day. You know, it's really important, especially as you get a little older, be sure you're getting the nutrition you need. If you have things that might be keeping you from sleeping, or if you have digestive issues, or heaven forbid, mood issues, there are natural ways that you can deal with those things. You don't need to run to the doctor for a prescription. Probably doesn't work and has side effects too. There are many, many natural things. And if you're like me, with weather getting warm, working a lot outside, be sure you pick up some of the product called Ultima. This is the electrolyte solution that I love. Gives you all the electrolytes you need to be able to get out and work in that heat without all the sugars that you're going to get from the sports drinks. And let me tell you, if you've decided it's time to lose a little bit of weight, just a lot of things that will help you there and so that you still have the sweetness and the flavor that you're craving. There's so many different good things I can tell you about Rhonda's. She and her staff are just wonderful with their knowledge. Great supplements. I take things to support my immune system. And, I've been working hard enough lately that I was having a little issue with muscle cramps at night. Well, she gave me a product that just takes care of that totally and all natural. She also practices reflexology there at the store, along with Beamer light therapy, red light therapy, things that your doctor will tell you are extremely effective. Get out and see Rhonda and her staff. This shop is out. The store is out in the northwest part of town. The little shopping center there at the corner of I-10 and Callahan, let's see, that would be on the southeast side of the street, kind of across the parking lot from Sprouts. Open every day except Sunday and major holidays. Get out and see my friends at Rhonda's Nature's Way.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, my next two callers are Shirley and Adam. Do have a couple of open lines, so grab one if you like. 210-599-5555. Shirley's next. Good morning, Shirley.
Hey, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I have, of course, a St. Augustine yard. And I've gotten from you in the past, I have a gallon of molasses, soil activator, liquid seaweed, and a small one of garret juice. I want to put some of that liquid on my yard. Which combination would I use?
You can use any or all. I think the garret juice is probably going to be the most important of the liquids at this time of year. But if you want to fortify it with a little bit of extra molasses, that's just fine. But we just kind of, everybody wants to kickstart their grass. And the different things, the liquid seaweed will certainly help. But I think the garret juice and maybe a little extra molasses would be the two most important things. And keep an eye out for June bugs. If you're seeing any June bugs, get some beneficial nematodes out before too long, because looks like we're going to have an early grubworm season this year.
Yeah, of course, I use that. I get those from you and the sponge. But it might be time to do it again. They're great. I have dogs here, and I certainly don't have any trouble. But I have a hose end sprayer that I got from you all. If I use molasses and garret juice, would I put in half and half, and then what would I set it at?
I would use maybe one-third molasses and two-thirds garret juice, or even a fourth molasses and three-quarters garret juice, and then I would set it to mix it about 2 tablespoons per gallon, 1 ounce per gallon.
Okay, per gallon. Okay, that sounds great. Good, because my front yard looks great. It has no breaks or anything on the St. Augustine.
Excellent, excellent.
But my backyard needs a little bit of help. Now, this same thing can be put, any of those can be put on my garden, all the flower beds and everything?
Oh, absolutely. Now, if you have flowers already in, you have white flowers, when you add the molasses, well, even with just the garret juice, you're going to get a little staining on the flowers. So try to direct the spray toward the ground more than necessarily all over the plants. But other than just a little, brownish stain to it, there's absolutely no negatives to applying those products.
Okay, great. Yeah, I do know that the molasses tends to stain, but that doesn't bother me. But anyway, another question for you. Do you have a bunch of your vegetables in down there, like squash and all that stuff?
We have lots of tomatoes, lots of peppers, lots of eggplant, and we have a selection of squash and cucumbers. I just find, I have to be honest, those two things grow so easily from seed, unless you're just planting one or two plants. I'm not real sure why you would buy the plants, because for the price of a couple of plants, you can get a package of seed and have, enough for lots of plants. But yes, we have all kinds of things. And a pretty good selection of herbs at this point, too. And a good selection. Some things you always start from seed, like bush beans. And this is a great time to be planting bush beans, black-eyed peas. A little early for okra. But the other things, no, go for it. I think it's time.
Okay. Yeah, I do do some of that stuff from seeds. But I have never done the squash by seeds. Isn't that funny? But
oh, it's
sure
just
could.
Sprouts.
Like zucchini and yellow squash?
Yeah, they sprout in about 3 or 4 days this time of year.
Ah, so that sounds good. I can do that. Okay, now, compost. Mm-hmm. I know it's good on the grass. It's quite a job for me to get that done. But would that be to do with all of this other stuff or whatever? I do also have Medina.
Yeah. If you have the Medina fertilizers, I would put that on first. Compost is great, but like you say, it's some work. If you have spots in your lawn that look like they could use some help, that's where I would focus. I mean, it'd be great to put over the entire yard, but not everybody has that much time or energy. So I'd start with the areas that look like they could use a little help. And then as you have the, you know, time and the effort, get out and apply it in some other places. But, you know, you kill yourself trying to do the whole thing, you know, in one sitting. So just start with the areas that need help and then expand outward.
Okay, great. Sounds good, Bob. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your help. Have a good one.
You do the same, Shirley. I appreciate the call. And next in line is Adam. Good morning, Adam.
Hi, good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
I had a question for you. So I got a some sort of red oak tree. The trunk is about 3 inches in diameter.
Okay.
It's about I wanted to estimate around more or less 15 feet high.
Uh-huh.
My issue is that it's about 2 feet away from the foundation and about 2 feet away from the sewer cleanout.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to see, is it possible? Is it too late to transplant that? Or what
I don't see any reason to need to transplant it. Is your home on a slab?
It's on a slab, and I live off of Helotes area, so
yeah.
The ground is pretty hard.
Right, and your sewer system is a solid pipe. It's not the old tile sewer line.
Yes, I have the PVC clean out sticking up above.
Yeah, I would not be concerned. It's going to be years. And I guess eventually roots, you know, just could start pushing against that. But roots don't, I'm surprised at what some people think, that roots somehow have little drills in them that get into sewer lines. Only if there's a break in the line will you have a problem with roots getting into it. And there's nothing underneath the slab of your home that a tree's roots want. Very little water, no nutrient, no oxygen. So that tree is going to be putting its roots out in the opposite direction. Now, at some point, you may have to worry about limbs rubbing on the roof or rubbing on the soffit. You may have to do some trimming to keep that from happening. But it's going to be years before you're going to have any real concerns with that, with those trees. So don't plant any more of them that close. But again, my friend Ed Etter, who's, you know, best tree care company I know of, brought some pictures by a while back. They were trying to show somebody who was so concerned because the tree was close to their home, and he had taken the air spade and blown all the dirt back away from the foundation down about 2 feet. And you can see how the roots run out toward the foundation and then spread laterally. But a home that's properly built has a deeper, what's called a grade beam, all the way around the outside edge. And so that tree doesn't really, like I say, it might cause problem with roof and soffit at some point down the line, but it's not posing any problems or any threat to your foundation.
Okay, so it being like a couple of feet from the front porch foundation, the foundation itself, it should be fine then?
It should be fine. And also keep in mind, your foundation was there first. Now, if you if you poured a foundation over existing tree roots, that could be a problem because those roots are going to continue to try to grow. But your porch, your home were there first. You put the tree in afterwards. And like I say, there's nothing under the foundation that those tree roots want. So 99% of them are going to be going the exact opposite direction. And Like I say, if there's ever an issue, it's probably going to be more with the tree rubbing on some part of the house, and that's probably years down the road.
Okay. The interesting thing is it wasn't planted. It just started growing all of a sudden about 6 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, like about 6 years ago, six, 7 years ago-ish. And it just started growing, and I noticed the leaves, and I thought, you know, it's a beautiful tree, so I just left it alone.
Yeah. Well, if it was 5 feet tall, I would tell you to transplant it. If it's 15 feet tall, no, that's going to be tough to do and require some heavy equipment and just really not worth the effort.
May I ask you another question?
Yes, sir.
So let's say I had a tree, whether it's the same tree or a different tree, same size and all. If ever you want to get rid of a tree like that, now knowing this, I'm going to leave it there. But let's say I did want to get rid of it. If I was to cut it down to a stump, what would be the best way to stop the roots?
Well, first of all, if it's a red oak or a live oak, even if you cut it down to the stump, you need to seal the cut because you can actually get oak wilt started through a stump, a live stump, where a tree's been cut down. So first thing you do on those is be sure that you seal them so you're not looking at oak wilt issues somewhere down the road. But the best thing to do would be to drill a bunch of holes, put just a spade bit, paddle bit, whatever you want to call it on your drill, maybe an inch diameter, and drill a bunch of holes as deeply down into the stump as you can. Fill with what they sell as either stump remover, it's actually just potassium nitrate, saltpeter, whatever you want to call it. Fill that and give it a little bit of time. The saltpeter, the potassium nitrate, reacts with the wood fiber to form something called nitrocellulose. It's not going to flame up or explode or anything like that, but after a few weeks, a really hardwood tree like a live oak, you might want to wait 2 or 3 months. You put a few charcoal briquettes on top, light it, and it just smolders all the way down into the ground, and the stump's gone and no resprouting.
All right. Well, I appreciate it very much, Bob. I hope you have a great weekend.
And you do the same, Adam. Always good to hear from you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Let's see. Looks like we get to talk at this point about the suppliers, Adam's Supply, but what we talk about is their Nature's Creation products. And there are so many good products, so many natural products in the Nature's Creation line. Oh, good soils, great fungicidal cornmeal mix. They package green sand and all sorts of things. But they wanted me to focus today on their lawn food, or turf food is what they actually call it. Good basic fertilizer, poultry litter based, and wonderful for trees as well as shrubs, as well as grass, just about everything out in your yard. It's a great product, and of course, totally non-burning, and nothing in there that we would object to. It's a good slow-release fertilizer and provides everything that your plants need to grow well. They also fortify it with, I believe, 4 or 5 different strains of mycorrhizal fungus, which makes it even better. You're going to find it at lots of different places around. If you're over in Victoria, Earthworks will have it. Down in Corpus Christi, you'll find it at Naylor's, up in Fredericksburg, at the Friendly Natives. Fanix carries it. Lots of different people carry quality products from our friends at Nature's Creation.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Looks like it's going to be Diane and then Jeff and then a man with a very good name. It'll be Bob. Right now, Diane's first. Good morning, Diane. Hi, Diane. You there?
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, or loudly and clearly, I guess I should say. How can I help?
How are you doing today, Bob?
It's just an absolutely gorgeous day out there, and I'm glad to be where I am, but it'd also be a good day just to be playing out in the sunshine.
I hear you. I'll be doing a little bit of that behind my lawnmower today.
And that's the way to look at it.
Okay, so I have a large ceramic pot that I've got plants in. And apparently during the winter when there's no occupying plants, the ants moved in. So I know there's something with molasses and something that I can put in there, but I don't want to do it too strong because I don't want to fry my plants if that's possible.
Sure. So. I just use a spinosad drench. If you want to start out, you could try a bait like the Come and Get It, which, you know, spinosad's the active killing ingredient in that. But if you want something that's going to, you know, kill with no harm whatsoever to the plants, just drench it thoroughly with spinosad or spinosad soap. Last resort is starting to think about dilute orange oil and things, but orange oil can burn. But with spinosad, there are no negatives to it. It's a great ant killer and totally harmless to your plants and along with your pets and yourself.
Okay, and do you know, because I don't think I'm coming to San Antonio this weekend, is that something I can get just about anywhere?
I imagine Green Gate has it over there, or I don't honestly know about your box stores, but any nursery or feed store should have it.
Oh, Becker Feed Store. Okay, and have you by any chance come across anything for the leafcutter ants? I had a thought. Here's my thought. Do we know the kind of fungus they like? And maybe I can grow it and just feed them like pets so they don't have to go out hunting for my food?
Well, I'm sure someone does know the genus and species of the fungus, but you have to look at the plants that they go after, which are, you know, they don't go after everything, but they go after crepe myrtles, they go after roses, you know, the things that they go after. And I'm not sure. I guess if you dug up a cut ant mound, you could, you know, find enough of the fungus to inoculate it. But I'm not real sure why you would necessarily want to do that. The blasted things just seem to, you know, the more food they have, the more nutrition they have, the bigger the mound's going to get. It's not that they're going to be satisfied that they're, you know, that you're providing them with food. It's just, it's like, oh boy, everything's great. Let's make a lot of new ants. And no, I don't think that's going to accomplish
the,
not a good plan.
I couldn't believe how far they were walking. They like the blossoms that have fallen off of the red buds.
Yeah.
And they walked, I don't know who scouted that journey, but they walked really far from their hole to get those. And I'm watching them march all the way across the property, and I'm like, holy smokes, that's a journey. So anyway, you haven't heard from Bruce on what they used out there at Olive?
No, I have not heard. Maybe he's listening this morning, and he'll call or text. But no, we lost a real treasure when Sandy passed away, and then, of course, saws polluted their wells so badly, and then the cold hit. I'm not sure what's left of Sandy Oaks out there anymore. But I've got Bruce's number somewhere. I'll call him and see if he knows what Sandy was using as a cut ant treatment.
I appreciate that. Okay, well, I'll go get some liquid spinosad and drench the giant pot, see what happens.
Do that, or I might just share his contact information with you. I know I'd love to hear from you, and this time of year I have very little. This is the only time I'll be sitting down all day, I'll put it that way. And we'll do our best to find out from him, because I know she felt like they were having pretty good success with it, and if anybody knows, he will know. So I'll see what I can find out for you.
Awesome. Thanks, Bob. You have a great day.
And you do the same, and come see Axel when you get a chance.
I will. That cute guy.
He is, and he's just growing. And anyway, it's always good to hear your voice. Get out and enjoy, and we'll talk again. And I will move on to Jeff at this point. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Bob, and thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
So just a little bit of background. We live east of Seguin. We live in that little swath of the post-oak savanna.
Yeah.
I think you're familiar with. And we recently cleared about 3 to 4 acres densely wooded post-oak, blackjack, smattering of hickory. We had a lot of damage. We had a lot of dead trees. Anyway, really opened up the landscape. And so I'm curious, should we anticipate, you know, the endemic, you know, bunch grasses like the blue stem, and there's other smattering of ones. And then obviously, you know, I cleared a lot of beautyberry, and quite dense. And then we got rid of a lot of the invasive yaupon, which really had started to take over a significant amount of
in the hill country. Right? Everybody's planting it. If you go very much further west, and the further east you go, it's a weed.
And
yeah.
I want to get rid of it because it really is. I mean, it'll just take over. But anyway, I thought we did a really good job of clearing. Should we anticipate some of that blue stem, some of that, you know, endemic bunch grasses to possibly come back, or can I do something to promote that? Obviously, we opened up the canopy, right? So we're more, we're going to get a little more sun.
That's the main thing, but realize that most of those range grasses, they really want basically full sun. So you're not gonna, I don't think you're gonna be overcome with KR blue stem or some of the things you don't want. But you're gonna have the things that you tried to take out. The beautyberry has left lots of seeds behind. Yaupon's the same way. You might again accept at least a little bit of nature's diversity. I'd think about plant maybe some Turk's cap in there. But the about the only grass, if you want grassy things, I would think about something like inland sea oats. And of course, it's all competition. If you plant other things that are going to compete for the water and nutrients and things, you'll have less of the undesirable grasses. But Mother Nature hates bare soil, and she's going to plant something even if it's sticker burrs. But a lot depends on how much light is hitting the surface of the ground. That's really going to determine what kind of grass and how much of it you have growing. You may also, if you want to plant something, there's some of the sedges. I know when I walk around my ranch, it's you don't see much grass in the more densely covered areas, but you see a lot of the cedar sedge growing, which is very grass-like and is reasonably attractive. So you may want to plant some things to discourage some of the grasses that tend to be invasive from coming back. You might call Dean over at Douglas King Seed and ask if he has any kind of blend that would be good to give you a ground cover without being real weedy, and it's just as a matter of competition. If you get desirable plants in there, they're going to work to suppress the things that you don't like.
Okay. And I think the caller, Donna, before... Yes, I still have not solved the cutter ant issue. I have tried multiple things, and so if you get some of that information from Bruce, boy, that would be wonderful if you could share that. And I'm still actually this area that we cleared. Uh-huh. We have a what I call a beachfront that they've really set up, and we did clear the tree that they were close to.
Right.
But I'm looking to see how they migrate. I've seen them pop up a little bit.
Oh yeah.
I haven't tried to spot treat any of that area yet. But
sure. Well, again, get some wettable sulfur. If you know where the mounds are, try to drench it. It's usually sold as 50W, which stands for 50% wettable sulfur, and because that is a natural fungicide that will go after, you know, their food supply. A lot of people in some areas have been able to cut way back on them just by flooding them out, but, you know, your post-oak savanna area, your soil drains so well over there, it's hard to... you know, really do a good job of flooding them. Spinosad will kill them if you can find a way to get it down into the mound. They're very resilient, I guess is the best way to put it. I don't think you'll ever eliminate them. We just have to try to keep them under control.
Right. On the wettable sulfur, could I obviously add the water, but could I just drench versus trying to... And what I do is I try to poke through the mounds, right, to break through those caverns.
Right.
But if I just drenched with the wettable sulfur, you think that could be somewhat effective?
I've had people that found it very effective. I've had other people that say it just hardly slowed them down. I think a lot has to do with the nature of the underground structure that they have created, so to speak. But yeah, if you can do it fairly widely, and of course the nice thing about the wettable, you can carry it down into the ground. If you poke numerous openings down into their big underground chamber, it gives you all that much better chance of reducing their food supply, which is going to reduce their numbers.
Right. Well, my wife's about ready to do the nuclear option.
Well, and if you have to go nuclear, I know it's not organic, but I've known people who would simply take, you know, just take a digging bar or something or a piece of pipe and break down into that chamber, get one of those room foggers, turn it upside down, set it off, and cover it with plastic and literally fumigate the mound. And it's not like, you know, using something like Roundup or 2,4-D or some of these really bad things that are going to be around forever. I would follow it up with some molasses or something like that to stimulate the microbial growth. It's going to eliminate any of the residue that might be around there. But when it comes to fighting them, sometimes you just don't want to give up your garden to them. And you can protect trees, of course, with the sticky stuff you put on, you know, some foil or something you've wrapped around them. But when they start getting into your garden, you just kind of pull out all the plugs and get the big guns after them.
Well, they've gotten into the barn, and so they're going for the alfalfa, which they, you know, they love. It does great. Produces
a
lot of fungus. So
just be sure that you're able to distinguish between the leaf cutting ants, which are generally black, have a big head and big jaws, from the harvester ants, which are your red ants that are actually not that bad, and they're a very important part of the food chain for a lot of small creatures. So, but no, I can't think of anything good about the cut ants. So, if you find something that works, share it. We want to help everybody we possibly can.
Well, thank you so much.
It is my pleasure. I appreciate the call. Thank you. All right, let's get our last break of the hour out of the way now. And I have the pleasure of talking about Sam Sitterly in Green Grow Organics. You know, Sam just does such a good job and has for well over 30 years now, helping share his knowledge of compost tea. And he and his crews, just for years, they have worked as consultants to folks having problems with their landscapes. And, you know, people would call him out on a regular basis and he would help solve the problems. Well, now he's taking it a step further and set up a quarterly program where if you'd rather not wait for something to go wrong, you'd rather have somebody that automatically will come out and fertilize and take care of things. Well, that's what this new program is all about, only there's no long-term contract. You're not signing up for something that you can't discontinue if you decide you'd rather do it yourself. And nobody knows more about proper landscape care. They come out on a quarterly basis and take care of the feeding, the beneficial nematode application if needed. At least on an annual basis, they're going to give you a good source of all the different micronutrients and rock powders and things that your landscape needs. But it's just, it's peace of mind. You'd be amazed how often that quarterly comes around and you're out there trying to get things done when you don't have the time. Why not let Sam and his good people take care of it for you? Again, he's always going to use organic products only. And like I said, there's no long-term contract. It's just a great addition to the way to get your lawn taken care of, your landscape taken care of properly. He is Sam Sitterly. His business is Green Grow Organics. Check him out online at greengroworganics.com or give him a call, 210-599-5565. That's Sam Sitterly and Green Grow Organics.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
And believe it or not, speaking of Magnolia Pancake House, that one out on Huebner actually has kind of an event center out there, and one of our employees is actually getting married out there. Anyway, it is a great place. Listen, I don't know why they shove such a large commercial break in there, but real short on time here, so we're going to wait and talk to Bob after the visit with Howard Garrett. We'll remind you, it is a great time to get out, get some fertilizer on your yard if you haven't already done so. Compost, you want to get it out before we really get into hot weather. And it is certainly time to be planting things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplant, squash, cucumbers. There's so many things to do today. Lots of pretty flowers to put out there now. Don't plant your caladium bulbs yet, but you can set out caladium plants. So much more to talk about, which we will do after news and after a visit with Howard Garrett here on KTSA San Antonio, Texas.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. Talk to Bob now. 210-599-5555.
Well, we need to change that little intro to listen to Bob and Howard now, and then the last few minutes of the show, we'll have time for a few more calls, and then we do this all again tomorrow from 8 till 11, followed by Your Pet's Health with Dr. Dan Kirby. Right now, it's the Dirt Doctor's turn. Good morning, Howard Garrett.
Good morning, and how is everyone?
Celebrating the first week of spring, and it is absolutely beautiful down here. Hope it's the same in the Metroplex.
It is. There's an interesting photograph in the Dallas Morning News this morning. It's showing lichen on some trees, and they explain the photograph as it being pollen on the tree, and it's causing people to breathe in a tough way. We need to get a little bit more accurate about things, I guess, when we take pictures of things that are supposed to be giving us allergies.
And you wonder if they make mistakes that basic, how much of the rest of their news is flawed. But we won't go down that path right now. But that's,
I think it'd be pretty easy
funny.
To come up with a number, yeah.
That's something else. Well, I tell you, it's been really interesting. And we're seeing some unusual things, some of them good, some of them not so good. The wildflowers down here are just absolutely spectacular. I've never seen as many blue bonnets or as thick as they are right now. I haven't really been out on the highways much, but just places around town and a little bit out on I-10, but wildflowers are spectacular. The thing that I'm getting lots of calls about and that I certainly have on my own ranch are some of the blasted thistles. And my experience is that the thistles, especially that big old Russian thistle, are somewhat cyclical, that some years you'll just hardly ever see one. And then you have years like this one where they are just everywhere. And what are you telling people, if anything, to try to control these things with?
Well, the best thing to do is just mow them down and then throw a little compost if you can, or at least some shredded native tree trimmings in that area. And try to out-compete them. If you do that, it encourages the native things to try to germinate and get going. And then if you get regrowth, then that's when I recommend spraying the 20% vinegar and whatever mixture that you would like. But first thing to do is just try to out-compete them, mow them down, throw some shredded native tree trimmings in that area, and people are really surprised about how well that works and in a fairly short period of time, really.
Yeah. It's just there are so many, and I've got places where I can't mow, and I wind up in there with the grubbing hoe, and one good chop, cut it off an inch below the ground level, and you probably won't see it again. But it's been a pretty strenuous exercise program, but it's just really interesting to me, and I guess it probably has to do with the combination of moisture and temperatures, but this is just one of those years that we've gone for probably 5-6 years where you would just see an occasional one here and there. And this year, there are thousands of them, and I'm hearing the same thing from people all across the Hill Country and east of town as well.
Well, my big weed problem starting today is to get my little mattock out and cut off the shoots of bamboo that are growing 2 feet a day. That process has started, so my assistant and I are going to be spending a lot of time on that today.
Well, it's just anybody listening out there, clumping bamboo is wonderful. The spreading kind of bamboo, like your neighbors planted many, many years ago, I know people that moved to get away from that stuff, but it's really not all that hard to control. It just takes a little determination and understanding how it grows.
Yeah, you got to do it right now when it's growing in the spring. Get those big old purple shoots cut off at the ground and kind of feel around where you cut the shoot off, and you'll find the yellow rhizome. Chop them up just a little bit. I use on a sharpshooter and just chop straight down. If they're not too well healed, I'll pull some of those rhizomes out as I go.
Uh-huh.
But that works great. You get a little secondary growth, a little feathery kind of growth later mm-hmm. on, and it's easy to just chop off. And that pretty much shuts it down. It's movement. It's not going to stop. You have to do it every single year, but it's it really does stop it in its tracks pretty well.
Yeah. It's and if you're in an area where you can, you know, trench a little bit and put a barrier in there with one of the better steel edgings or something like that, you can slow it down. But I tell you, I've seen it kind of come up over the top of that, and bamboo is, and again, I love the clumping bamboos, the Alphonse Carr, the Golden Goddess, some of those, but boy, the ones that, like you're fighting, it's just, like you say, it's just, it never goes away. You just have to plan on spending a day every spring and getting ahead of it.
Yeah, it's not any big deal, and it's a great benefit to us because it's holding a really steep slope from eroding and falling down the hill. So
yeah,
it's a benefit here.
Yep. Well, we're seeing some interesting things on trees here, too. A lot of things are really leafing out. In fact, a lot of things have just totally leafed out. And yet some other things, like the pecans, have barely a leaf coming out on them. They're really slow coming out. But the oaks, for the most part, and I think we talked about this last week, the live oaks especially, have just shed every leaf. And they're starting to look really good, but there's still trees out there that just haven't started into their spring growth pattern yet. It's real strange.
Yeah, one of my trees that looks like it's almost, it looks like it's dead. The buds are barely swollen on it. It was one of my buckeyes, and I got them backwards the last time I was talking about it. The one that's mm-hmm. going the slowest is the Ohio buckeye. The native
uh-huh.
ones are
yeah.
fully leafed out. The
yep.
red buckeyes are covered in red flowers. In fact, they're even going downhill. The white native buckeye is fully leafed out, hadn't started flowering yet, and the Ohio buckeye doesn't look like it even feels very good. It'll be fine, but it's just interesting. It's going so slow.
And it's the probably the most cold hardy of all of them. And
yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's good that we don't know it all. It's good that that Mother Nature just has to throw something a little bit different at us to make us think a little bit. But it's been an unusual year. It's beginning to look like we will escape having any more severe cold, which is a good thing. And we've actually gotten some good rains. At least a lot of people have. Roberta got an inch out of that little system that came through when I got like 1,500s. But they're giving us a fairly strong chance of rain two or three times later in the next week or 10 days. So if it'll keep this up, it's going to be the prettiest spring we've had in a few years.
Well, it's amazing. Up here we're getting really nice rains, and they're spread out pretty well. The
uh-huh.
Ground, you know, we got rain Thursday and yesterday, and the ground was sopping wet. I had to call off doing any work because I was
wow.
afraid to do damage to the soil. But today the moisture level ought to be pretty good to do some work. And then we have rain coming again in a couple of days. From the plant standpoint and soil moisture, we've had almost ideal amount of rain up here,
right,
bordering on being a little too much.
How are your surface impoundments? Dallas has lots of lakes around. Are they all pretty much full?
Oh yeah, everything's great.
That's that's the other thing.
Borderline.
That's the other thing's bad down here. I think Canyon Lake up just, you know, north of us is still at only about 60%, and Medina Lake, which is an agricultural lake, is down somewhere still under 10% full. So we're getting moisture that's helping the plants, but we haven't had the kind of rains to, you know, put the water back into the aquifers and put the water back into the lake. So we're a little ways behind you, but hopefully that'll change. And I hate to say it, we need a small flood right now to really fill things back up again and get the rivers and creeks flowing. But where they are, it just could be a prettier spring. I was walking along my creek, which about two-thirds of it is running now, and looking at the maidenhair fern coming out and some little brake ferns. And It's a pretty spring out there, no matter how you look at it.
The only problem we've had is, I think it was the city of Plano had a rupture in a sewer line or something along those lines, and it dumped a bunch of raw sewage right into White Rock Creek, and of course came all the way down to White Rock Lake. And I don't know, I think they were giving out warnings there for a while about going out in the lake, so I hope that is mitigated by now.
Well,
always something.
And I think we mentioned the other day, we're down here, of course, the city of San Antonio pays the composting companies to take their biosolids, and we're having trouble finding good biosolid-free compost and soil mixes and things like that. I don't know if y'all are seeing any of that, or I don't know what the city of Dallas does, if they what they do with their treated waste, but it's making it tough for those of us that want to see biosolid-free soil mixes out there right now.
Yeah, Dallas doesn't do that. I think they end up sending it to the landfill, I guess. Mm-hmm. They have the sewer treatment plants and the typical ponds to settle it all out, but they're not doing any manufacturing of any products that I know of at all.
Well, my hat's off to them for doing so. I know Houston has, for a long time, and Austin both are actually making and promoting fertilizers made with the dillo dirt and the huactinite and things like that, but we haven't seen that. But did you get your concrete poured? Last week you shared pictures of the forms up for your gardens that you're working on out there. Did you make progress on it this week?
No, that's the negative about the rain.
Sorry about that.
pretty much shut that thing down. It's finished. Reinforcing rods and that kind of thing are going in. We had a few minor tweaks and adjustments to it, but it'll be poured this week, I would imagine, unless that rain that's in the forecast blindsides us one more time. We're lining up all the plants and trying to decide whether to plant transplants or seed or both. We're trying to do a little bit of both. And we're getting the tomato cages lined up and the tools for the property. It's rocking right along right now.
Oh, that's so good. What are you using for soils? Are you using just a basic garden soil mix, or are you doing anything special there?
No, I'm using my recommended bed preparation that I recommend
that's
for
good.
Everything. The
that's
native
good.
Soil and compost, and then heavy amounts of azomite. I'm recommending heavier amounts of azomite than the company even recommends. One of my listeners mentioned that to me the other day. But especially on bed preparation, I like to use up around between 40 and 80 pounds per 1,000 square feet. And
yep.
They recommend on the package, I missed this actually, they're recommending rates of down around 5 pounds per 1,000 square feet. But I think when you're doing the bed preparation, using plenty of compost, plenty of lava sand, plenty of azomite, and 20 pounds each of the dry molasses and the whole ground cornmeal, you get a fluffy bed. You mix it into the existing soil. No need to go deeper than 8 to 10 inches. A lot of people will fill raised beds completely full of their mixture, and I keep trying to talk people out of that. I also don't recommend something that I've heard other people recommend too, and that's put mulch, shredded native tree trimmings in the bottom of the bed, and then put put the soil mixture on top of that. I don't like that idea either, because that's going to break down and cave in and have a funny kind of moisture situation even in the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, with us, mulches on the surface are great, but don't put them on the bottom. And, above all, don't put plastic or anything like that down. You know, where you're sitting on good soil, let those plants' roots go as deep as they can, as far as they can. And there's so many. We could do a long book on mistakes that we have seen made in gardening. And how do you feel about where people have grass are worried about coming through? Either cardboard or newspaper down toward the bottom of the bed. I don't find that as objectionable, and but I sure.
No, that's fine.
Yeah, I hate weed block. God, I hate weed block. It's just we're seeing so much more of it, and so many people putting it down and putting rock on top of it, and that's just going to be a long-term disaster.
Well, at this same project over, we've got the community garden. The landscaping was kind of in a mess, and I brought in one of my favorite arborists to do the root flare exposure and trimming, and we had to cut some of the live oaks in the front that are near the community garden back anyway. But the most interesting piece of that project was an area of white gravel that had three pine trees in it. I'm not even sure what kind of pine trees they are. They're very unusual tops. And the arborist asked me if what I thought about taking the gravel out, and I could see that there was roofing felt. Paper under the gravel. And I said, yeah, let's, I checked with the owner. Of course, he said, fine, so, sounds good. So all that was taken out. And then what was put back in was a shredded native tree trimmings. And it's going to be really interesting to see the improvement in those pine trees because they looked fairly decent with that horrible kind of planting at the base. And we took several inches of soil off of the flares on them. A lot of people don't realize that a pine tree has a flare, but they do. It's just smaller, a little bit different kind of a flare.
Well, it's, again, you need to get some good pictures of what the soil looks like underneath the so-called weed block, because this business is saying it allows the soil to breathe and all the other lies that are told about the people selling it. If you want to ruin soil, it's a real good thing to put down. And I will admit that when I have expanded my vegetable garden in the back and I had really tough native grasses to get rid of, I just put the weed block down over it for 6 months or so. And then I had some revitalization to do afterwards. But it's just people that think they're going to put it down and cut a hole in it and plant something, that's just not going to work well in the long run.
No, it doesn't work well at all. And I did get shots already of the soil that was around the base of the trees as we pulled that felt back. The soil didn't even look like soil. It looked like wet concrete. It had no texture to it at all. Again, how those trees were doing as well as they were doing, I have no idea, but it's going to be fun to see the improvement that they have with this new situation that they're going to have. One of the other things that we ran into, this is a project that the company that I work for, they bought this place from somebody else, so a lot of the landscaping had been there for a long time. And as you would guess, most of the trees were too deep in the ground. Mm-hmm. And we ran into that situation on the live oaks where you have that spaghetti effect. And one of the trees, the spaghetti roots, had so fused together, there's just a big, giant knot that's formed on the one side. And I'm still scratching my head and talking to the arborist a little bit about exactly what we're going to do. Right now, we're leaving it there for a while, but we may go back in at some point and try to do a major operation to remove it completely. It's a little bit of a head scratcher, and live oaks are the only trees I've seen so far that do that development, that fusing like that, as severely as they do.
Well, please, you know, document it and let us know what you find. We found some of that on this tree, you know, here at the nursery that we did the exposure and took out some girdling roots and things like that. And I have to say it appears to be coming out much, much better this spring than it has been.
But I wondered if the regrowth had started on it.
Yeah.
Usually you see the improvement the very first growing season after you do that base work. It's pretty amazing.
And live oaks are such resilient trees. I'm amazed at trees in general. You know, we rarely eat inside this time of the year. If we're going out to lunch, it's going to be on a patio somewhere. And we were sitting out at one of our favorite sushi places and looking around at the area where there's been a lot of development, a lot of office buildings, a lot of asphalt over root zones and things like that that's been there for 20 years. And it's just amazing how well the live oaks have done, even with that kind of pressure on them. And at least they, you know, some of the places we see this, that when they pave, they put down a piece of pipe with a little piece of welded metal on top with fairly good holes in it to try to help it get a little bit of oxygen back in the soil. But I'm continually really amazed at how well good oaks, how well pecans do, how well they've tolerated some of the horrible things that developers have done to them.
Yeah, you don't have to grow trees. You just have to allow them to grow, allow them to reach their potential. And it is amazing how the live oak is without question one of the most durable trees, if not the most durable tree. It can yep. take construction on a new site, for example, better than any tree I've ever seen. They're not going to grow as well as they should, but living through some of the things I see live oaks tolerate yep. is pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, they probably haven't grown as quickly, but I guess they just have such an extensive roots, having been there for, who knows, 30 or 40 years or whatever. And then you go a little ways away and you get into the real wimps of the oak tree group, as far as I'm concerned, the post oaks and some of those things that are just look like they're just sitting out there looking for an excuse to die when we get, you know, unusual cold or unusual heat. But it's an interesting genus of plants, that's for sure.
Yeah, the lacy oak, Mexican white oak, my low quiet leaf oak, all those at the office are doing great. They did defoliate a little bit more than they usually do the evergreen ones, but they're all looking great now, growing like crazy.
So. I had a caller this morning asking when the leaves were going to stop falling, and I said, just before the tassels come out and start falling. That's one thing about the trees. They can be messy at this time of year, but I think it's going to be just a beautiful spring because of the fact that pretty much almost 100% of the old leaves are gone. Everything that's coming out is new and bright green, and I've been really pleased. We've put out a bunch of the Trichogramma just because I was worried that this would be a year for the gallworms and things like that. But knocking on wood, have not seen that that's been much of a problem down here this year. Not seeing much caterpillar damage at all at this point.
Well, it'll definitely shut down the caterpillars. They're a problem. There's no question about it. Any kind of galls, the best thing to do there, of course, is the sick tree treatment. It's just amazing
right.
how the galls just go away. And the mistletoe too. On the flowers from the oaks, they're covering my roof right now. I'm having to blow every couple of days, get up there and blow it off. Our roof is so flat, it'll block water. But that stuff makes a good mulch. People shouldn't think that that's something negative and throw it away or anything. If you put it in the compost pile, that'd be the last resort I would use.
Yep.
I'd just use it first to cover up bare soil and use it as a mulch. It really functions beautifully as a mulch.
I would think it has a lot of nitrogen in it too, since it has so much proteinaceous material, and proteins, you know, typically contain a lot of nitrogen. So I'm like you, I think it's one of the best things people could use for a mulch, or blend it in with some of your shredded material or whatever else. I can't imagine throwing it away. I think it's highly beneficial.
It's all out there and in my beds all over the place right now. It is every year. And of course, it breaks down, and it's so fluffy, it breaks down and doesn't leave much volume there for you at all long term.
How are your maples doing this year? Our Japanese maples, I know Orangeola is one of your favorites. Ours are coming out beautifully, and yet some of the ones we don't care so much for, the Shantungs, and some of those look like they're struggling a little bit after the dry summer and some cold. But the better varieties they're talking about something that's just coming out with some beautiful new foliage this year. Ours are just wonderful.
Yeah, mine look great. And all mine are on my website under Japanese maples. All my Howard's Garden ones are just spectacular this year, and the red ones as well as the ones that come out green first. I haven't seen any negative at all. I agree 100% on the Shantung. I think it's a lousy tree.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing a lot of cases. The first one I ever planted in Dallas was at a previous office, and it started falling apart so bad the people that are there now have taken it out.
Hmm.
And I only have one here, and I planted it on the neighbor's property. It's on the other side of the fence. It's not even on my property. And it every year it has a bunch of dead wood in it and just, like you said, limps along. There's one near my office that looks like a big Japanese maple in the front yard, but it's young.
Yeah. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to watch it through the years and see how well it holds up. I think it's going to end up being in the category of those hybrid maples that, you know, are a cross between the red maple and then that, what's the one that's such a crummy maple? Anyway, we get those hybrids, and they are all going downhill faster than any of the plants around. I think the Shantung is the next level. They'll last a little longer, but not much.
And then same thing's true of the Bradford pears and some of those things. They're just where, you know, years ago when we had a lot of development going on around the nursery, they planted them, and for two or three years, oh, beautiful spring flowers and beautiful red foliage. Now there's hardly a one left. I was looking at another one that had just, you know, totally split apart about 6 feet off the ground like they tend to do. So wish people would pay a little bit more attention to the Dirt Doctor and all the good information out there on dirtdoctor.com when it comes to the trees that are really going to perform well over a period of time.
Well, the pears are even going to the next stage. They've been banned in certain states now.
Oh, really?
Because they've become so invasive. I used to recommend the Callery pear instead of the Bradford pear because they had a more open branching system.
Right.
And it had thorns, was the only negative. But, yeah, some of the states, Ohio, I think, is one of the first. But there are places where there are tons of reports coming in that the things are germinating from the fruit and popping up all over the place. So they've been put on the invasive species list, as has been Chinese pistachio, by the way, if people don't realize that yet. And I'm one of the culprits for promoting that tree big time in the past, but now it's one that should not be planted anymore.
Well, you know, I tell people that's why Steve George had to flee the area, because red-tipped photinias and the Chinese persage were two that he just made out to be most perfect trees in the world, and he got out of town when the truth started coming out. So at least we've learned the proper things to replace them with and things that have done very well over time. But anyway, I hope it's a wonderful first week of spring for you guys, and I guess I'm planning to be around. I know next weekend is Easter weekend, but I plan to do the show on Saturday for sure. So hopefully you'll be available and we can continue this discussion. And, you know, I'd like to just kind of do a shout-out and tell people if they have topics that they would like us to toss around to let us know, because I get a lot of good questions and a lot of things, as you do on your shows. But if people let us know that they'd like a discussion about any specific topics, I just enjoy so much our time to throw ideas back and forth about all different aspects of gardening.
It's always good. We'll see everybody next week. In the meantime, enjoy this nice weather and those healthy gardens.
Howard, thanks once again, and we'll do it next time. And everybody remember dirtdoctor.com. If you're looking for information on the internet, that's the only place to go. Most everything else out there is from a different part of the country, but Howard's just up the road from us here in South Texas, and believe me, the information you find there is going to be very much applicable to the Hill Country and San Antonio area as well. So Join the Organic Club of America. There's just a lot of good benefits out there. Let me get a quick break in here, and then we'll get back with time for a few more phone calls. Bob, if you're out there, we'll make you first since we ran short on time before the break. Right now, I get to talk about Wild Birds Unlimited, and we talk about how beautiful the plants are, but so are the birds. The hummingbirds are back in town, not in huge numbers yet. The American goldfinch, along with our native blackback goldfinches, so beautiful. And so many of the birds out there getting into their really bright plumage as we move into nesting season. Anyway, Wild Birds Unlimited is a place you need to go to find the proper food for your birds, the things that they need to support them as they raise their young, and the feeders to do it with. Most of their feeders have a lifetime guarantee on them. They've got the cleanest, freshest seed out there and blends that work well, along with the appropriate suet cake. It's just, you're going to find all sorts of good things at Wild Birds Unlimited. You're going to find what you need in nesting boxes as well. Purple Martin houses, they've got them. And lots of just beautiful things for the yard. Wind chimes, sun catchers. Wild Birds Unlimited is a fun place to shop for all kinds of things. And the knowledge that you have out there, Kyle and all of his staff, oh gosh, Bill and all of them, they can talk to you about anything related to nature and birding. It's just always a pleasure to walk through their door. Out there in the shopping center at the corner of Northwest Military and Huebner, they're going to have very soon, they're also going to have a location on the north edge of Burney out there, second location of our good staff for Wild Birds Unlimited here. And that's just so many interesting things. You'll take a look at the shop from a distance and think, oh, gee, that's not a very big place. I always say you walk through the door of Wild Birds Unlimited and you say, how on earth did they get so many different beautiful things in here? Join me. That's where I do a lot of shopping for gift ideas and got to go see them about some other things real soon. Get out and enjoy things. And if you have any questions, feel free to give them a call. 479-BIRD. That's Wild Birds Unlimited.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster, News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. As we promised him, Bob called back, and so we're going to make him first. Chris will be next in line after that. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Bob. I got
morning,
a couple
sir.
Of quick questions for you.
Yeah.
Do you have any fire bushes in yet?
We have the variegated firebush. That's the one that some of the big growers are growing, so they got them ready. The standard darker leaf form, haven't seen them on the market yet, but that one with the kind of gold variegation in the leaf and the same dark flowers, yeah, they're available. And, oh, gosh, when I looked yesterday afternoon, we had some of them. And things change in a hurry on the weekends around here, but haven't seen the darker ones yet, but the variegated ones are the first on the market, and they're out there.
Okay, my next question is, I want to put down some Medina for my spring fertilizing, and I want to put down some compost. Should I put the Medina down first and then the compost on top of it, or vice versa?
It doesn't really matter. I think you optimize it when you put the fertilizer down first, because the compost is full of the humic acids and things that really start freeing it up. It supports the microbes, or the microbes in the compost support the conversion of the fertilizer to things that are what we would call bioavailable to the plant. So given the choice, fertilizer first, compost on top of that. But if for whatever reason you're forced to reverse the order, you're still going to come out very well.
Okay, do you know a spreader brand or a recommendation to pull back behind a lawnmower? Because I want to do it on my yard, and my tractor's too heavy. I'll end up rutting it up real bad.
I got a field spreader that I have put behind my gator and things, but I don't know. I would try, trying to think of which one of the good farm and ranch stores. You might check Fred's place down in down in Divine. Why am I drawing a blank on the name? But I would try a good farm and ranch store, and that would probably be the best place that you would have luck finding them. Morales feed is what I'm trying to say. Call Fred Morales down there and ask him for, you know, a homeowner size that you could pull behind, you know, like a riding mower or something like that. And I they've got to be out there. I just don't have a specific brand that I would recommend to you. The other problem is that I don't know of any that you can really control the opening. That's the push spreader. Of course, you know, you're gripping it, you're opening the base of it, and then you let go and shut it off so you're not throwing fertilizer out all the time. I don't know of any of them that would be the kind that you pull around. You pretty much have to, you know, open the little thing in the bottom and start driving. But I guess if you're an inventor, we just found a great new product for you that you'll probably do very well with. But I call Fred Morales and ask if he has one that's small enough to be pulled behind a lawn tractor, but big enough to hold at least a couple of bags of fertilizer.
Okay, and my last question is, I got somebody that was talking about cutting down their small mosquito and stuff bushes, trees. Mm-hmm. Should right. they be, will that kill them? Do they spread no. like, you know, like your cactus does?
They don't really spread, but they come right back out. I've got places where, you know, I've cut them down 20 times and they still come back. And it's not organic, but I'll tell you what I've resorted to, and it works very well, and that is just pouring some diesel over the stump and then following that up with molasses. The idea is the diesel kills and then the molasses cleans up the soil. The microbes that the molasses stimulates, it actually, you know, pulls any toxic material out of the soil. But even the product that I hate, the stuff called Remedy that they sell, and it spreads to the soil and kills trees way, way away from where you put it down. But they recommend mixing that with diesel to put it out. I find that diesel alone doesn't go beyond where you put it. It effectively kills the base, the underground portion of the mesquites and weesach for that matter. And then just following up with some molasses cleans the soil up again.
So would you cut them first before you put the diesel on it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Cut them down to ground level, and then it may be a cup or it may be a quart, depending on how big it is.
All right, sir. I sure appreciate it. I'm going to try and get down there to see you one of these days.
Well, I hope you're able to do it. One other thing I say, not for your benefit, but everybody else, people that have big old mesquite trees, don't cut them down, because the mesquites produce something in their roots. It's called alleliomorphic, that keeps the mesquite seed from germinating. Mother Nature has allowed them to sort of dominate the area. The people that really fight mesquite are the ones that cut down their big trees. They lose that natural suppressant, and then they just get that thorn growth all over the place. So if you got big mesquites, don't worry about it. They're not really hurting anything, but it's where we're fighting those young ones, the ones that are away from the old trees that sprout and come up. That's where you sometimes have to resort to pretty extreme measures to kill them completely.
All right, sir. Well, you have a good day.
You do the same, and I appreciate you being patient with us. And, Jimmy, let's go ahead and get our last break in, and then we'll talk to Chris.
South Texas Gardening with Bob Webster is on the air. News Talk 550 KTSA and FM 107.1.
All right, back to gardening. Man, this 3.5 hours has gone by in a hurry today. Hope you're going to spend a bunch of time outside today. It's going to be beautiful. Probably finish up calls with Chris. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
One question on, I've got a couple of questions, azomite and rock phosphate questions. So I wanted to start with azomite. And I know that that you like the granular version, but I live in Middle Tennessee, and the only thing that I have around here that I found is the micronized version of that. Do you recommend me picking up a bag of that? Would that still benefit me, or should I just try to find me some granular around?
Well, the only reason I recommend the granular so highly is because it's so easy. The micronized form is going to be faster acting because obviously there's more surface area when you grind it down. But taking the time to, it's you know, the best way to put it out, of course, is just to put it in a water suspension and spray it out, and that's why they micronize it. But I'm sometimes lucky if I, you know, get 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there to get out and get something done in the garden, and I just don't always want to take the time to go get out the sprayer and, you know, mix it up and then go out and spray and then have to clean my sprayer out afterwards. It's strictly a matter of convenience for me. The micronized, there's no reason you couldn't just sprinkle it around by hand. There's no reason you couldn't mix it in, you know, to, you know, if you're making a potting soil or a bedding soil to start seeds or something like that. It's you can certainly use it. It's just ease and convenience is the only reason that I like the granular form better. The powdered is obviously, you know, the same material. It's not going to burn. It's not going to have any problems. And in that you have a lot more surface area, you'll probably see results more quickly. So by all means, use what you can get. And when you make your trip down to this part of the country, pick up a few bags of the granular to take back and just see which one works best for you.
Okay, and when I'm using that, of course, I can use it in my garden, but I've got my fruit trees and then just my regular trees. You know, would it be a good thing to, like, every couple of weeks to do a foliar spray maybe on my fruit trees and things of that sort, like, or it on the ground? Or
I think that it seems to be more available when it's applied to the soil. I haven't, like I say, I haven't sprayed as much of it, but in places where I've mixed it up and poured it over the foliage of some of the yellowing, I didn't see that it greened things up any faster than, you know, where I just put it over the root system. So it certainly won't hurt anything, but is it necessary? It's a fine way to do it, but I haven't seen any added benefit from a foliar spray with it.
What would you say for, like, a gallon sprayer and do I have to filter it? What would you say for a gallon sprayer to how much to put in there per gallon sprayer to spray around the trees?
Yeah, a couple of tablespoons. And
okay,
you really can't filter it because there's nothing there that's going to leach out. It's going to be acted upon, you know, by the microbes, by carbon dioxide gets released from the plant's roots that forms a carbonic acid, and this is what sort of starts dissolving and freeing up some of these minerals and things that are in the azomite. So it's never going to burn. It's never going to cause any problem, but I haven't used enough of it as a foliar spray to really make a specific recommendation. And obviously you can't filter it or you'll be taking it back out, but what you have to do is just continue to shake the sprayer, just continue to agitate it, because it's not going into solution, it's going into suspension. But if you know if you're putting it in the sprayer, and if you're able to agitate it as you go, and then just rinse and flush, you know, some clear water through the sprayer when you're through.
Okay, and then just kind of just spray it around my base of my fruit trees if I'm going to do that, and then go to the next one, spray it for a little bit, and then
and
kind of apply it like that maybe.
You know, and take one or two and, you know, do a foliar spray as well. Make a note of which ones you did that to, and I would love to hear back from you if you're seeing any differences.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, my other question is rock phosphate. So I know that you prefer the powdered version of that. I've been using for 2 years the granular in the bottom of my, you know, my tomatoes go directly on that blob.
Right.
But I heard you say the other day about you liking the powdered version. I was like, crap, I got the granular. Should I? Is there any way to, like, grind that up, or should I?
You don't need to. You don't need to. It's with our soils, you know, because of the alkalinity, it becomes tied up in a form plants can't get to. Middle Tennessee, you don't have that problem. It's going to work for you fine. You could probably blend it into the soil. I just like putting it underneath so the plants can put their roots directly through it. And just making that layer of the powdered form without the soil mixed into it is that just works better in our soil conditions, but you have a little bit better soil than we do.
Would you say, Bob, to blend it in the bottom, or would you just say to put that glob and put it directly on the granular? You know
again,
what I mean?
You try both and let me know what works best for you. If you want to talk to us tomorrow, we can. Right now it's time for Martin Bomba. This is KTSA Radio, San Antonio, Texas. Thanks for joining me.